is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface in the heart of the Moho discontinuity, it's your weekly hub for the strange, the unusual, our little dark corner of the web. That's right, it is the Grailian Report. Welcome to the program. I'm your happy host, Mr. Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. Joining you live in studio along with a fantastic staff that, well, they're probably the kind of people that you'd normally see on board some space shuttle someplace. That's how good they are. To my right, the producer extraordinaire himself, Mr. Chris Hayes. Chris, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Micah, Matt, and greetings to all you boils and ghouls out there in Radioland.
Indeed, yes, and of course you've given it away. The Reverend himself in studio behind the master console, pushing all the right buttons, running all the right levers. I'll tell you, it's a supercomputer, the likes of which most will never see, and Matt Oakley is the man behind it. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, and you know, when he says supercomputer, it's actually one of those, like, huge computers they used in the 60s. That took up like 8 rooms to calculate 2 plus 2.
Yeah,
we
actually got it from the Batcave. That's what you're saying. So
yeah, that's why we're asking for donations.
I thought it was super because it deflected bullets because it was made of lead.
Wait, hold on. We're asking for donations already?
Well, that thing on the site.
That thing on the site.
What do we look like? A charity case? I'll take your donations and I'll throw them
on the ground.
Throw it on the ground, boys. Oh, goodness. You can't throw it on the ground because we're already so far underground that, like, if you throw something, it just hangs in midair.
Then I'll throw it up to the ground.
Yeah, throw it up to the ground. Yeah, throw it up. Throw it up. Anyway, yeah, we're broadcasting from a hollow bunker deep within the Moho discontinuity. Literally hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface. And that, it means only one thing, my friends. Those of you who are in the know are already well aware that this is the Grailian Report, and I am Micah Hanks. Welcome to the program, my friends. We have so much to discuss tonight, and I'm so glad, you know, that we have dodged death and destruction one more time, because between the hours of 6 and 8 p.m. Eastern Time this evening, we were under the potential threat of mass destruction, you know, end of the world as we know it, you know, the typical kind of thing that always happens here on Terra Firma, planet Earth, because, of course, a city block-sized asteroid was said to have actually been zooming by Earth tonight. Not just said to have been, this thing actually was. Fox News reported earlier today that an asteroid, as described, again, the size of a city block, would zoom by Earth inside the orbit of the moon today, but that it would pose no danger of smashing into our planet, according to scientists. The asteroid was called 2005 YU-55. I only say was because, well, the thing is probably leaving Earth's orbit right now, but it's about, get this, 1,300 feet across. It made its closest approach to Earth at 6:28 p.m. Eastern Time today. At that point, the space rock was believed to have been traveling about 29,000 miles per hour, but would be 200,000 miles from Earth. That's closer than the moon, of course, which orbits 238,864 miles from Earth on average, but nonetheless, that's, as many would say, a little too close for comfort. And that's how close this thing was. They called it a flyby, an asteroidal flyby. And it would mark the closest such of a big space rock in terms of coming that close to Earth since 1976. But, again, catastrophe averted. And I don't think that there was any real threat of danger from the get-go. One of our Grailian Report field correspondents, Mike Reese, called me earlier today, and we were talking about that. And, you know, I'd hoped that we would be able to actually get out and see this thing. But, you know, apparently, though it was that close to planet Earth, you wouldn't be able to see it unless you had a 6-inch telescope to be able to see that. So we weren't able to view this. Binoculars aren't good enough to do that. And unfortunately, I just don't have a really, really well-equipped, handy-dandy telescope. You know, when are we going to get the Grailian Observatory involved? I think that's the next step. We've got a bunker. We've got a masterful radio broadcast facility, but we don't have a telescope. We don't have a Grailian Observatory.
Well, basically, excuse me, what we're going to do is next time we go visit the Brown Mountain Lines, before we do that, we're going to take a really quick detour onto the campus of Appalachian State University. What? Go Mountaineers. And take over their observatory. They have the largest observatory on a university in North Carolina.
You know, I'll tell you this. We need to take over that observatory because an old buddy of mine actually makes regular use of that, and that's none other than Dr. Dan Caton of App State. Dan and I, of course, have been, I'll say, associates off and on for years and years. I don't have a problem with Dan. I don't think Dan likes me very much. He thinks I'm a ghost hunter, okay? Because apparently anybody who talks about UFOs and aliens is a quote-unquote ghost hunter. You got it?
I don't like you, but you pay me.
Oh, Lord, man.
Well, I mean, that kind of makes sense because now scientists have decided that aliens are more than likely the result of dreaming.
Oh, really? The result of dreaming, just like ghosts and goblins and ghouls and all this sort of thing, huh?
Yes.
You know, I don't doubt, and this is the thing, you know, this is, I guess, where the skeptic in me comes out. I don't doubt that the majority of this sort of phenomenon actually is... I don't know, let's word this carefully. Maybe not entirely imaginary, maybe only partially cultural. I think that to truly understand this strange world around us and the phenomena that we discuss on this program that every now and then kind of intersects with our reality, we have to be able to take into consideration the power of the human mind and human perception and the way that humans as three-dimensional biological organisms interact with reality. We don't really know what reality is anyway, and taking into consideration the illusory nature of things like space and time, really they're more references than actual physical substructs as we perceive them to be. If we take all these factors into consideration, we are faced with the likelihood that not all things that we see or touch or smell or feel or hear in this world are exactly as they appear to be. And therefore, what we're dealing with when we deal with strange phenomenon, although it may not be entirely physical, indeed it may partially stem from the way that the mind perceives various aspects of reality, it may not be imaginary or hallucinatory, per se. And I think that that's where we get into fairly difficult territory, because a lot of people, when you start saying what you saw a Bigfoot, or you saw a strange light in the sky, and what you saw may not have been entirely physical. I think people really get offended. People just, they really don't like being told, hey, listen, you know, you may not have seen something that was actually, in the conventional sense, there. You may have been witnessing some sort of a strange phenomena that, while partially there, obviously observable and very real and physical to you, it may have appeared different to others in the vicinity. Or you may have even played some sort of a strange role in the actual manifestation of that object. This is the idea of the tulpa, okay, or the thought form, I guess, as they call them here in the United States. But the notion tulpa, I think, comes from the Tibetan language, and a tulpa is essentially a thought form, a manifestation that is created from focused and intense concentration by an individual, a meditative process. The same sort of thing, I think, you know, really... could be derived from, you know, descriptions of what they call golems, you know, in the Hebrew Book of Formation. The actual physical process by which a golem is made is understood to be like, you know, God making man from mud, you know, and, you know, bringing Adam to life. You would literally make a sculpture, a mud man, and then bring it to life by writing something on its head. But the thing is that most people don't know this, that preceding the actual physical creation of a dummy body, okay, that's going to take on some sort of a life of its own, a la Frankenstein, there is an intense focused meditation that precedes that, where you literally create this kind of spiritual essence of this individual through focused meditation, and then that you know, ethereal form comes into the physical body, and that is the creation of the golem. So, I mean, throughout various cultures, there are different kind of takes on this idea of bringing into reality things that literally stem, at least partially, from the human mind.
Well, I thought golems were always considered to be soulless automatons.
Yeah, essentially.
But if you're creating, you know, if you're building the ethereal spiritual form of it and then infusing it into the physical clay body of the golem, then wouldn't it then, you know, technically have some kind of soul, well, instead of just being an animated lump of rock?
How do you define soul, you know? And that's the million-dollar question. Well, yes, of course, zombification of Chris Hayes, ladies and gentlemen. It's an ongoing process here, which actually, I think, really, again, our proximity to the Earth's core Which is not molten, folks. Let me just tell you right now, we're close enough
it's
to be able to...
It's made of chocolate.
Exactly. Yeah, we know these things. The moon is made of cheese, and we've got a chocolate core down here, hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface. We're almost close enough to go down to the Moho, and at the right time of year, you know, chocolate syrup literally flows right down through there.
And we're really... Imagine the Earth as a big, rocky Cadbury egg.
It's kind of like the Keebler Elves commercials, really.
That's right, and except there aren't cute little elves rolling around. There are Hadels.
Horrible potato-faced Hadels.
Potato-faced.
They glam it up for the kids,
they've,
you know?
They've got, like, eyes, but lumps all over their face that look like the traditional eyes on the potato, the little sprouts coming off. They've got small, tiny fingers growing out of their face. It's a horrible sight.
I love that. And by the way...
they make the best cookies.
Mountain Green Sleeves, or MT Greens, Green Leaves... On Twitter, this is one of our listeners. This individual tweeted me this week, referencing an article that apparently appeared at the Daily Galaxy titled "Earth's Hadal Zone: Clues to What We Might Find in Alien Oceans," and the tweeter followed by saying, "Micah Hanks called it effing Hadals." So, but you know, this is an actual location. Do you know about the Hadal Zone? The Hadal Zone is actually the actual name given to the deepest recesses of the of Earth's oceans. If you actually go down to the very base of the ocean and then you get into, like, you know, crevices and cavities. Do you remember the film The Abyss?
Yes.
Okay. In The Abyss, you know, they literally, I think they go down, and then they literally go all the way down until they get to, like, a great big chasm down on the base of the ocean, and then the ocean, of course, continues down into this chasm. Those kinds of locations, the deepest depths of the oceans within these deep, 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 and probably, incredibly pressurized crevices deep within the earth, below the oceans, those are what are called, actually, the Hadal Zone. But now...
And I think that's the part of the ocean where the water comes up into your boat and like mimics your face and everything too.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah,
that's what I thought.
But unlike the film, where there are these friendly, benevolent aliens underwater, we know what really hides in the deepest recesses of the Hollow Earth. No, it's not the friendly little Keebler elves. It's not them at all. No, it's those damned Hadals. If you don't know what a Hadal is, you don't listen to this program often enough. Which is every Tuesday from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. It is the Graylian Report, and I'm Micah Hanks. We are your ambassadors of the unexplained, keeping you company every week here in our dark little corner of the web. When we come back, more strange news and a little bit about this ET disclosure thing in Washington.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the Inception Radio Network.com. We'll see you there.
Of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Thank you, John Anderson. It is the Graylian Report, keeping you company every week here from 8 to 11 p.m. And, you know, we're talking about city block-sized asteroids literally flying into Earth's airspace. Very interesting stuff. We'll touch on that more here in a minute, but first we'll go to the phones. Caller, welcome to the Graylian Report. Caller, are you with us? Hello.
Yes, I'm with you.
Hi there. What's on your mind tonight?
Is my mat right sitting right there?
Is your mat sitting right here? Uh-oh, Matt, are you paying off your family members to call into the program again?
I have no idea.
Uh-oh, we're going to play...
At least I don't remember.
We get to play 20 questions with our caller now. Matt, go ahead.
Yo, what's up?
What's up with you? Are you single?
Am I single? Good Lord. This is... Wow. I think this radio show just shifted gears pretty... Pretty heavily, yes.
Folks, it's live radio. We don't plan
kind
this.
Of, like the Spice Network.
I don't know.
Well, I'm interested in where this is going.
This is pretty intense conversation.
Matt, are you single?
I don't know if I'm going to plead the fifth on that, maybe. I don't know.
But aren't you usually single, though? Even when you're with someone?
I don't know, man. I think this is a pretty existential question. Going on here.
That's an interesting question. Caller, do you have anything that relates to aliens, UFOs, or anything else that might be on the table tonight to chat about?
The only alien that I know of is Chris Hayes. He's the only alien I know on Earth. He is the biggest alien we've ever met.
The Sandy Ritchie.
Yeah, wow.
How are you?
How are you boys doing?
We're better now that you're here.
Well, I knew you guys missed me.
Of course.
You guys sound so happy to be reunited. Sandy, listen, I tell you what, if they're not enthusiastic enough that you're on the program, I certainly am.
Well, I love all of you guys, and I am thrilled that you guys are doing this. You guys are a good group of boys, and stay out of trouble.
Good group of boys. I don't think she knows us very well, does she, Jill?
We're actually contractually obligated to stay in trouble, Sandy.
Yeah.
We knew that.
if you'd like to help us stay in trouble, we'll take suggestions.
Okay, we need to do drinks. You call me.
Guys, Sandy, they'll have to do that off the air, though, unfortunately.
That's fine. Oh, and goodness. I love all you guys. You guys have a great night, okay?
All right, you too, Sandy. You too. Thanks for calling in. that's a genuine paranormal anomaly. Someone calls in and asks if Matt Oakley is single.
I know. Well, I was like, what the hell? This has got to be a trap, man.
Yeah, you thought I'd set you up. See, I'm a good friend like that.
He's going to have a heart attack, man.
Yeah, what we're gonna have happen, since you're never gonna propose to your longtime girlfriend Alexa. So what we're gonna have to do is we're going to have Alexa call in and propose to you on the program, Matt, live on the air, so that our listeners can actually hear that. Oh yes, it's really going to happen. So if you'd like to call into the program, of course, and join us, just like our friend Sandy just did, you can reach us here at 828-398-4886 by phone. If you'd like to call in via Skype, Skype ID is Graylian Report. You can reach us that way, too. And, of course, we're also telling folks that if you don't want to call in at all, but you want to bother me by sending me text messages all night, you can do that also. Just send a text message anytime at 828-367-7201. All that information, of course, can be found at our website, which is the Graylian Report. And if you've been living in a hollow bunker for the last 10 or so years, like we have, then you can just visit www.graylian, that's graylianreport.com. And there you can just go to the right-hand side of the toolbar at the top of the page where it says Graylian Report on the radio. Click that page, and all the information about how to tune into the live stream, how to call in, and how to send us text messages, emails, all that stuff, it's right there. But while you're there at the website, I want to draw your attention to something else, too. Our lead story at the Graylian Report right now is titled, The White House Responds, No Evidence of Extraterrestrials. This has become a hot story for folks this week, and I'll tell you why it's so important to us here at the Graylian Report, because only a few weeks ago, Matt Oakley had touched on this. Now, Matt, actually, would you like to give us a little background on exactly what this story has to do with?
Well, it all centered around the White House website, and what is it, the We the People section?
Yes, this is a new, I believe that the Obama administration began to provide this portal, if you will, at the whitehouse.gov website, where it's essentially, if you can garner enough support through a online petition, what was it? You have to have a certain, I think it's what, 3,000?
I think was 3,000 within, it was something like 30 days, I believe.
Yeah, I have to look at the information. Anyway, the point is, all specifics aside, you get this certain number of petitions signed within this period, and you will receive an official response from the White House. And this is kind of the way that they weed out the most important issues to the public. Okay, and so, of course, what we expected, I believe, was that the Paradigm Research Group decided that they would put out a petition calling for release of information regarding two extraterrestrials. This is getting into the realm of what we call exopolitics. You'll also notice at the top of the page of the Graylian Report where it says weird news anomalies and exopolitics from beyond the fringe. A lot of people are like, what the hell does exopolitics mean? Well, now you know. This is what exopolitics means. This is the ongoing effort by people who try and use political action to get information released, usually from, you know, the U.S. government, but this also occurs in other countries around the world, pertaining to UFOs. Given the assumption, okay, and I say this because I think that there are a lot of assumptions with regard to information about UFOs and what are perceived to be extraterrestrials, groups petition to try and get the release of this information based on the assumption that governments are withholding such information. Now, I don't doubt that there is information pertaining to UFOs that the government has probably sat on for decades. We're talking about the American government here. And that this information is, for various reasons, probably kept clandestine and from the general public. But the thing about this petition that you got to keep in mind that makes it a little more difficult, I think, for people in terms of getting what they want and what they're looking for is that specifically the wording in the petition calls for the release of information pertaining to extraterrestrials. Okay? Now, what is an extraterrestrial? Extraterrestrials literally deal with creatures that come from outer space, not of this planet Earth, but probably some biological beings that come from elsewhere in the cosmos. But the problem, I think, with UFOs is this. We don't have direct evidence supporting the idea that these things are ETs. Now, this really bothers a lot of people. As soon as I start saying this, people are like, wait, hold on. Wait a minute. Now, there's this individual, and this individual has come forth, and this one has. I mean, and if we want to look at people who have come forth and you know, and even in government, in U.S. government over the past several decades, who have described having had encounters with what appeared to be otherworldly aircraft. I mean, look, we can go right back to John F. Kennedy, who had described to the then director of NASA that he was working on there was a plan for a joint space program between the U.S. and Russia. And Kennedy, in a memorandum, had actually even said we have to be able to identify the knowns and the unknowns so as to ward off the perception that we might be operating craft behind one another's back, okay? And many people have wondered exactly what Kennedy meant when he said knowns and unknowns. President Ronald Reagan, before he served as president, he was governor of California. He was actually flying in his private jet, and he, of course, witnessed some sort of a light, and so he told the pilot to follow that light. I'm sorry, I don't think it was a jet. I think it was just a small passenger plane. But he told the pilot of the plane to follow that light. Jimmy Carter, before he served his term as president, had a similar experience. Many people have. Many presidents. I believe that, was it Webb Hubble, who had served in the Clinton administration, had said that President Bill Clinton had come to him when he'd been appointed and said, I want you to find out two things. Actually, hold on. This is fun. Let me do my Clinton voice for you. Webb, I want you to find two things for me. I want you to find out who killed JFK, and I want you to find out what the deal is with UFOs. But he wasn't able to figure out either, okay? And I think that, and it comes back, this is what's interesting with Jimmy Carter. When he was president, you got to keep in mind that then the director of the CIA was George Bush Sr., George Herbert Walker Bush, who would, you know, later come to be president of the United States following Reagan, preceding Clinton, and then, of course, his son, George W. Bush, would come into the presidency. But when George Bush Sr. had been director of the CIA, and he was approached by then-President Jimmy Carter about UFOs, who said, you know, can I have information or access to information regarding UFOs? The CIA director, Mr. Bush, told Mr. President that, sir, you don't have clearance for that information. I've always asked this. If the President of the United States doesn't have clearance for that information, who does? But now here's the thing that we have to keep in mind. These people were all asking about UFOs. And we don't know for certain, if we don't know what UFOs actually are, we certainly can't leap to a conclusion with certainty that UFOs represent aliens from outer space. This is what I'm always talking about. And so the problem with this recent petition is that people were saying, hey, we need proof of extraterrestrial intervention here on planet Earth that the government might be hiding. And guess what the response was? Here's what the response was. I'm going to actually read a quote for you here. This is from the We the People response that was issued by the government. It says, "The U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race." If we don't have any evidence to support the idea that UFOs can be directly linked to aliens from outer space, then that is not an inaccurate or untruthful statement. And so I think that if anything, based on the criteria designed in the verbiage, in the wording of the We the People statement that I guess was it Michael Sala that actually issued or kind of spearheaded this movement, when the exopolitical folks come out and they're pushing for proof or release of information that would prove that extraterrestrials have been visiting planet Earth, and then the White House comes out and says we don't have any proof. Again, let me read that statement for you. The statement says as follows, that the U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that extraterrestrial presences have contacted or engaged any member of the human race. What that seems to mean is that while we can't discount that UFOs are flitting around out there in the atmosphere, flying around and doing all this and that, and they're being seen by governments and pilots and, you know, military officials and even presidents of the United States, you can't deny the reality of the UFO situation, but we can't jump to the conclusion that there are extraterrestrials potentially behind this. Chris, did you want to jump in with some commentary on that?
No, you pretty much said it. I mean, in the chat room, hang on, let me get to that window. I've got so many windows. In the chat room, Red Pill Junkie said, "So Mike is basically saying the We the People site is Aladdin's genie," to which I replied, "Yes, you've got to phrase your wish or your petition to the government regarding, you know, UFOs or extraterrestrials, depending. You can only pick one, because they're going to use you choosing both as an excuse to not talk about the other. You pretty much have to phrase your requests in lawyer speak."
Exactly. And that's the thing, is that, you know, I don't think that it's wrong that people feel outraged that the government seems so, you know, hesitant to be, you know, forthcoming with information about UFOs and what are, you know, believed to be extraterrestrials. And by the way, let me correct myself. I'm getting my exopoliticians mixed up. I'd said Michael Sala a moment ago. While he is a known advocate of exopolitical disclosure of UFO data and perceived extraterrestrial intervention with humankind, it was Stephen Bassett that was the founder of the Paradigm Research Group. This is the exopolitical group that's been working on this recent We the People movement, or rather this petition within the We the People program, if you want to call it that. The Paradigm Research Group is an exopolitical group that he founded. They've been working for a long time on disclosure of information regarding what are perceived to be extraterrestrials. But like Chris said, when it comes to getting an answer to the question, you have to be very careful in how you phrase the question. And what people asked for in this instance was, well, basically proof of ET. But the thing is if there isn't any evidence that directly correlates extraterrestrials with UFOs, then were people just asking for the wrong thing?
It's possible. I know it wasn't a two-part question as far as the petition goes. They were asking specifically about extraterrestrials, but I just want to say something about the fact that two-part questions are inherently softball.
Okay.
Because whether you mean to or not, you're giving whoever you ask a two-part question to a way to not answer your question.
Okay.
That was really it. I'm sorry. It was a tangent.
That's okay. No, but I mean, but truly, that's the thing, is that, and I think that this is another thing that people take issue with. I'm sure folks, you know, some in the listening audience would probably hear me right now and say, you know, that's probably a little judgmental, you know, Micah, to you know, say that, you know, everyone who believes in UFOs, you know, thinks that these things are extraterrestrials. Obviously, that's not the case, you know, and I'm certainly not a proponent of, you know, UFO equals ET exclusively. Now, I won't rule out that possibility, but before the program, we were talking about other reasons I think that UFOs and ETs are so often tied together, okay? And I think it really... Actually, you know what? Skeptic Magazine this month has an article called, I think it's something along the lines of The Man Who Invented Flying Saucers. It's talking about the fantasy science fiction artwork of this popular author, or rather artist back during the 40s, I think it would probably be the 1940s, years preceding the alleged UFO crash at Roswell and Kenneth Arnold's sighting, you know, that same year in 1947. And they draw attention to these very, very saucer-esque spaceships that appeared in this gentleman's artwork. But in addition to that, you know, Matt, you were talking about, for instance, you know, films that, you know, probably went back several decades before Roswell and Kenneth Arnold's sighting that talked about, you know, space exploration and space travel and aliens.
Yeah, the one I was talking about specifically was the, I believe it was like early to mid-30s. I believe it was a movie called Man on the Moon.
Okay.
It was a silent film about, you know, this space shuttle going up to the moon and seeing all this weird stuff. And of course, there's still the man in the moon. So there's the face on the moon. It's really weird stuff, but definitely has some kind of extraterrestrial connotations. Okay. As early as the, you know, the 30s.
Yeah, and I know I when you say Man on the Moon, of course, I think about the, you know, the Jim Carrey film, you know.
R.E.M.
The song, you know, they borrowed the name from the song, you know, it was the Andy Kaufman biography of sorts.
Great
but, but who knows, it may have been the same title. Check on that, actually. See if you can find out exactly what that film was. But even if you don't count this film, we're looking for the earliest instance of cinematic portrayal of aliens from outer space. This was already something that was appearing in films. And furthermore, if you read a lot of the documentation pertaining to Project Blue Book, for instance, you know, the book that was written by Edward J. Ruppelt, the report on... actually, I've got it right here.
Where?
Right here, gentlemen.
Oh,
look, I'm holding in my hands right here the report on unidentified flying objects, the original 1956 edition by Edward J. Ruppelt. It was re-released by Cosimo Classics. This is a really good edition of the book, too, by the way, and I'm very glad to keep a copy here in studio with us. But the reason I bring this up is because Ruppelt actually oversaw Project Blue Book, which was the Air Force's project, which was looking, you know, in the official investigation by the Air Force, rather, of UFOs between 1951 and 1953. That's when Ruppelt was overseeing Blue Book. And here's the thing. These kinds of early reports that are described by Air Force officials and captains and pilots and military and, of course, Ruppelt himself gathering information, they were all talking about the possibility of extraterrestrials, but there's some revealing instances, especially when it comes to the discussion of what are called anomalous green fireballs and things that were seen flying around in the late 40s and early 50s. These sightings preceded our actual ability to travel into space and visit the moon. We hadn't done that yet. This wouldn't happen for several more years. And it's interesting to see that before our own serious attempts at exploration of outer space, these scientists were, of course, kind of gravitating towards notions of how, you know, extraterrestrial visitors from another planet might enter our atmosphere. And one of the theories was that as opposed to having to combat, get this, the trials and the troubles that would be associated with entering an atmosphere like Earth's using a flying vehicle, okay, re-entry, if you will, they said what they might do is they might send probes down that were actually designed to burn up in the atmosphere, and that some of these green fireballs that were seen flying around were actually extraterrestrial probes being dropped into Earth's atmosphere designed to burn up so that we wouldn't be able to find evidence of the alien intelligence that sent them here to begin with. That was one of the theories that was put forth by some of these scientists who were studying the early UFO enigma. And it's interesting because if you look at those reports and the interpretation by the scientific intelligence of the day, with regard to these UFOs, it's pretty obvious what was going on. They were trying to speculate based on the, you know, the fundamental knowledge that they had of the day, which was, of course, lacking compared with what we know today about space travel. And it seems natural, given that circumstance, the limitations of the technology of that day, that they would indeed question whether or not biological entities from outer space could be visiting Earth. And that idea, no doubt, became so popular, popularized already by films. Like, what was it, Matt, that you got the actual film?
Yeah, I actually pulled it up, and I was a bit off. It's a movie called A Trip to the Moon, and it's a French black-and-white silent science fiction film, and it was 1902.
Oh, 1902. Okay,
yeah,
so see, there were already these kind of pop culture references to space travel and space flight.
And to give you some kind of significance reference, that's only 2 years after the technology to create motion pictures was pioneered.
Yeah, you see, and that's the thing, is that it was already on people's minds. So naturally, when you see strange objects flying around in Earth's atmosphere, that appear to be highly advanced, far more advanced than any aircraft that you or I or anyone that we know or anyone in government or the military, anything like that, could potentially have at our disposal. And yet these things appear to be very real, and they appear to be flying out there and even buzzing our military installations and flying circles around our fighter jets and things like that. Well, it's a very real problem, or the potential for one. And naturally, I think that the human mind is going to gravitate towards explanations that fit the criteria for the anomalies being witnessed. Could it be that UFOs have so often and so long been associated with extraterrestrial presences just because of, well, people putting together pieces on their own without there being evidence? Maybe so. We'll examine that a little more when we come back. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report.
No, no, I'm kidding.
If you're facing foreclosure, talk to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
Join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
You wouldn't believe how many emails are coming in right now wanting to know more about whether or not Matt Oakley is single. Apparently that was a popular call, Matt. You're going to have to get your friends to call in and ask about your love life more often here.
I just want to know why the hell people are messaging you about it instead of me.
Well, let's just make this official. No, Matt's not single. He's with me.
Well, I'm going to send you guys both into Studio B.
So we can kiss?
No.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
You're ruining the...
Chris,
the,
you're ruining his moment.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
My mojo.
I just want to be no, on the I Love the Matt train, too.
Yeah, well, you've been on it for years. You're old school.
So
like,
I've been,
love-hate.
I've been on your train for years? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just a casual observer. I don't think I want to be. This is getting more and more disturbing. You know, speaking of disturbing, we're going to get to
it's
disturbing...
It's getting almost paranormal.
Well, this is going to be a good disturbing news story next hour that I think our wonderful producer has found for us. Did you know that certain conditions could allow for severed limbs and the like to grow back? Oh, gosh, it's really, really weird, but we're going to talk about it. But I'll tell you what, first, I want to get to something else. I think we've got enough time to address this. We were talking about UFOs, extraterrestrials, alien visitors. Now, I'm not going to say that UFOs are not extraterrestrials. However, I do endorse the idea, much like our U.S. government here in the States seems to do, that we may not be dealing with extraterrestrials, or that if we are, we don't have evidence that directly proves that or correlates these sorts of UFO sightings with extraterrestrials. I think that we, in the last segment, outlined what I think is pretty effectively why indeed, people might perceive UFOs as being such. And who knows, like I said, for all I know, they may be. I don't profess to have the answers, but I do ask people to use logic to try and discern what we can about these strange objects, which I don't deny by any means, in any way, shape, or form, that they do have a presence here on Earth, whatever they are. But I think a lot of them are man-made. I think that some of them may actually be physics anomalies or something else, maybe even some sort of, you know, what we might call in simple terms, time travelers. And then there's the idea of post-singularity humans. But what about this one? What about post-singularity aliens? What about aliens from another planet that have undergone some sort of a singularity? If indeed there were actually visitors from other planets that were visiting Earth, I think that in all likelihood, we've talked about singularity where you know, human biology merges with technology and the like. I think that any alien visiting planet Earth would have to be representative of a extraterrestrial race that has already undergone some kind of a technological singularity for them to even be withstanding the rigors of space travel. But then again, there are even U.S. patents that describe ways that electromagnetic spacecraft might be utilized in ways that could allow people like you or I to travel through space without any kind of problems that would be incurred afterward. And I just want to say, too, next week on the program, our guest, Tom Fusco, is going to be joining us to discuss his new book, Behind the Cosmic Veil. Let me just tell you, Tom puts some pretty interesting theories out there with regard to what he calls supergeometry and how that, too, might be an explanation behind some of the UFO mysteries. We're really looking forward to having Tom on the program to discuss that. And his book, Behind the Cosmic Veil, is already available on Amazon. You can check it out. We'll have links here at the website. But before we wrap up this hour, since we're talking about UFOs and aliens, we got an email from a listener this week, and I wanted to share it with you here on the program. This individual, I have been in touch with him via email, and initially I'd hoped that he would call into the program tonight. And he emailed me at the last minute and said that he just wouldn't be able to do it tonight, but that he hopes to do it in the future. And I would love for him to do that, because this is truly one of the most bizarre stories that I have come across in a long time. And therefore, I feel obligated somewhat to share it with the listenership on this program. It goes as follows. Back in the summer of 1977, this individual, we'll call him Jerry, and his father were driving a truck late one night. He said, my father must have seen ahead of time that I would wind up wasting my life on trucking like he did. I don't think trucking's a waste. I've known a lot of good truckers. But anyway, and Jerry says, so he started me early as he could. He took me on his usual run from Maryland to California with frozen seafood. We were slightly east of Kingman, Arizona at around 2 a.m. on July 22nd, the evening in question. We'd just come out of a rainstorm, and I was driving while the old man napped. A slight fog from the road heat kept me from seeing more than half a mile ahead, and just over one camel hump I spotted a large but dim, almost see-through light in my path, about a mile ahead of us. While I took the cruise control off and letting the engine brake slow our roll as we approached, I thought I saw what maybe at first was a wreck with emergency vehicles, you know, the usual. My father woke up to me slowing down, and as soon as he slid up to the passenger seat, his eyes got huge as oranges. He yelled stop while he almost jerked the trailer emergency brake clean out of the steering column, bringing us to a slightly sideways but complete stop right in the middle of westbound I-40. Now take a grain of salt with what I type to you here, Micah, because after so many years pondering on this, some things could be not as they appeared, but I promise you this is no drama rant. The red light I'd spotted on up the road was floating now, about 5 feet off the ground with a pulse of sorts, but never brighter than I'd say a 40-watt bulb. It was bright enough in the middle of the desert, though. Sitting above that light, in the air, about 25 or 35 feet, was the biggest thing I think either of us, my father or I, had ever seen. It was hard to judge the size of this thing, but it had to be, I guess, easily, maybe 100 foot per side. It was triangle-shaped. It had a sheer flat bottom and dim white lights at the corners. It appeared slim, couldn't have been 8 feet thick. Then again, I couldn't tell if the top of it may have been raised either. There was no sound whatsoever. It just seemed to kind of hang there, no movements, just motionless there in the sky. My father, being former Air Force, just stared at it. He had one hand on his hip and the other on his bill cap, and his head was just cocked straight back looking up at this thing. All I remember was looking in total disbelief, yet curious as to what the heck I was looking at. It looked like it had a black, flat black finish, an 8 foot section maybe in the middle, and that was real eye candy because it looked as if there were a glass section, sort of, around the whole craft, about 3 feet high, and it resembled what I can only call maybe a blue lava lamp with an LED lit backing with some kind of liquid in there swirling around. I walked to the back of this thing, seeming to point dead east, but it was the same thing all the way around. No engines, no jets, nothing. But I remember, It was the most perfect, sharp triangle I'd ever seen, even on paper. I kept asking my father, what was it? Where was it from? And all he could do was just shake his head slowly, still huge eyes and all. The stupid teenager that I was, I actually picked up a rock on the side of the road and I flung it directly at this object. Whatever the thing was made of, it didn't make a sound like a rock hitting metal of any kind. It kind of made a whoosh-type sound, like when you hit a plunger on a tire valve and you get that quick, short burst of air. But it dumbfounded me to no end. I'd say the total event lasted maybe 10 minutes. The vehicle eventually started moving away to the west very slowly, but picked up slightly as it went, still making no sound at all. We stood and we watched it float on down the road, and then it levitated at around 100 feet or so in the air. And then finally it took off to the east just like a bolt of lightning. No wind effect, nothing. It was just like it had been there, and then all of a sudden, it wasn't. Well, I wrote to Jerry after this initial story. I was quite amazed at this report. And as you can imagine, I get a lot of these here at the Grailian Report. And I wanted to know some more specifics about this craft. And he wrote me, and he said, as far as the craft, and forgive my lack of even drawing a sketch, which at one point I did have, here's what I can recall. The red light below the craft seemed to be almost like a hologram, or a laser-type projection maybe, kind of like the handheld scanner at the grocery store. The light was about the size of a large beach ball, a perfect globe shape, but as solid-looking as if it were... Now, let's see. He says it was... But as solid-looking as if it were transparent, if that makes sense. So I guess both solid and transparent as well. It was tethered to the craft somehow, but no visible attachments. In other words, it followed right along with the craft as it moved, never deviated, and I'd say that it and the craft were anywhere from 15 to 20 feet apart, so roughly the craft sat about 25 to 30 feet off the ground. The globe never went away during the sighting, so my best guess was maybe at like the grocery store, maybe some kind of scanning probe, maybe a directional feeler or some kind of engine that fed off the Earth's ley lines, who knows. The craft was an equilateral triangle. It was about 100 feet aside in length. All the sides were the same and about 8 feet thick with that blue lava lamp type band around the center that I mentioned before. Because of its altitude, I couldn't judge it right off the top as in terms of whether it was flat on the bottom and on the top as well. So all I can assume is that indeed it was the same on the top as it was on the bottom. If I ever run past a scanner and I can draw up a rendition, I'll send it to you at a later date, and I'll get to that as soon as I can. However, I can't call it anything but the average, triangle craft that's floating around in the fringe aircraft market. He says, I believe I saw a very good computer-generated rendition done by the History Channel or Discovery Channel a while back on one of their shows, and even have heard of similar sorts of triangles. He specifically references Leslie Kane's book, which we've talked about here on the program, as well as in other media over the years. All in all, I know I'm far from alone with my sightings. These cats get around, and that is for sure. Man, that's an incredible story. If you, the listeners, have had similar encounters, and you have seen strange, inexplicable objects in the sky, I would really like to hear about it here on the Grailian Report. All you have to do is just send us an email. Get ready and write this down. It's info@grailianreport.com. We're always interested in hearing those. And if you get really wild and you don't want to have to wait until next week to hear your story read on the airwaves, we'll be taking your calls live during the next segment. When we come back here on the Grailian Report, we'll give out that caller information, or it's available to you all the time at our website, www.grailianreport.com. Have you seen a UFO? I certainly want to hear about it. Maybe somebody's seen something as strange as what Jerry saw as well. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grailian Report. We'll be back right after this. Micah Hanks of the Grailian Report here. I just wanted to take a minute, really just 30 seconds, to tell you a little about a wonderful project I'm privileged to be a part of these days. It's called Intrepid Magazine. Intrepid is an eclectic melting pot of a variety of different areas of interest, ranging from politics and fringe science to mysteries of the unexplained. You'll hear from authors like Nick Redfern, April Slaughter, Marie D. Jones, and Larry Flaxman, editor and publisher Scotty Roberts, and, of course, yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Period. Subscribe today. Visit www.intrepidmag.com.
If your walls could talk, what would they say? I have sent children into fits of rage.
I am responsible for a child's speech impediment.
I am the reason a child can't read. Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Yes, we are light in the darkness, even though it's very, very dark down here in the Hollow Earth where we broadcast from. It is indeed Micah Hanks, and you've locked in. It's the Graylian Report. Joined in studio here by our friendly Graylian production staff, producer Chris Hayes, and our engineer, the Reverend Matt Oakley, who's not performing exorcisms for one night a week just so he can be here in studio bringing you beyond the fringes of insight and insanity. It is the Graylian Report. Hey, I want to draw attention to something real quick, folks. You may have heard during the commercial breaks, we have a new sponsor this week. My very dear friend, she's a wonderful person, Melody Germain. Her new business is La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. And let me just tell you right now, they are truly fantastic. I've been able to sample her remarkably good chocolate. Now, let me just tell you something about these, okay? I think that we all have guilty pleasures, you know, and I definitely have a sweet tooth. I love chocolate. But Melody's chocolate isn't just your typical chocolate. This stuff is so good for you. It's made with superfoods, all natural, raw, organic, gluten-free. There's no soy, no dairy, no refined sugars. It's all fair trade ingredients. You wouldn't believe the health benefits, the mood enhancement, you know, all the different kinds of benefits that you never knew that you could get from consuming chocolate. And that's truly what you get when you enjoy these wonderful, delicious treats from La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Melody, of course, supplied me with some of these delicious chocolates. Chris and Matt didn't get to eat any of them because, well, guess what happened?
Well, and that's why you've been at the dentist's office all day.
Oh, no. You have to understand, though. This is all. You see, Matt wasn't listening.
I've been called.
Well,
I've been calling.
Did you lose
around
time and somehow also a pound of sweet chocolate?
Let me just tell you, these things are so good for you.
It's like getting abducted.
Indeed. And if Matt were listening, Matt would also know that these things not only are pretty good for you, okay, but that every ingredient used in La La Land Organics Raw Chocolates are medicinal, okay? They're antioxidant-rich. They're anti-aging and longevity-promoting ingredients. They promote heart health, stress relief, mood enhancement. They reduce fatigue. They're fiber-rich. They even promote healthy libido, anti-inflammatory, appetite suppressants, healthy metabolism, and, of course, they're also conducive to supporting adrenal health. Because they contain superfoods, these are really, really good. And I kid you not, we occasionally play parodies here on the program and joke around about various things. But when I say La La Land, you know, that's the last place that you're going to end up if you enjoy these raw chocolates. They're really fantastic. They're made right here in Western North Carolina. And if you want to learn more about those, all you have to do is just visit the following website. Now listen carefully because you're going to want to write this down. We actually had one of our listeners in the chat room saying, I'm going to go out and buy these things right now. Go ahead and place an order. You want them right now. MDGNewMedia.com. Again, that website is MDGNewMedia.com. Check them out. They're fantastic. And for those of you out there who might want to also advertise with the Graylian Report, all you have to do is send us an email, info@GraylianReport.com. We can feature your products on this program so that thousands and thousands of listeners each month can now learn about your products and services just as well. But that said, moving right along, did you know, guys, that there is another fella out there now saying that the Patterson-Gimlin film is a hoax? Do you know what I'm talking about when I say the Patterson-Gimlin film?
Of course, man. It's one of the most, you know.
Yeah, it's that, you know, the thing with the thing.
I lost
the thing
my train of thought. I'm sorry.
He has no idea. I'm going to throw a pen at him.
Fine.
No,
fine.
Last time you
way.
Joked about throwing a pen at Matt, you threw a pen at Matt.
Yeah, right, I did, because he wasn't listening.
Oh, I guess I guess that means you weren't joking.
We're going to make Chris run the board again. You're going to be working double time, buddy. Sorry. You'll get
I knew
a
what you were talking
good.
About.
If we're paying... Hey, hold on.
Can you actually just pay me in chocolate?
What, yeah, we will, actually.
Lala's chocolate?
Melody will probably actually work that out. And that way I won't have to raise your
because,
actual pay.
I'll still accept
you know what
cash.
That, you know what that chocolate goes really well with?
What?
A fine Portuguese Porto.
Yes, indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, our libation of the evening. Just to show you that here at Grelian International, I take very good care of my friendly staff. We have Osborne Fine Ruby... Portuguese-made Porto, okay?
And also not one of our sponsors.
They're not a sponsor. This is just, you know, we like to, I'll tell you this. Red wine, I've found, is kind of conducive to focus enhancement for me. That and coffee. Those two beverages. If I have a cup of coffee in the morning, you see, I don't want to drink too much coffee late in the day because it's going to keep me up at night. And I barely sleep. You know what they say, no rest for the wicked. So I barely sleep anyway as it is. And so I try not to drink. I don't even touch decaf late in the day. And certainly not teas and things like that. But I tell you what, a glass of red wine not only kind of helps with digestion, but it also seems to kind of calm you down. And I've noticed if I'm ever getting in late night writing, if I have a glass of red wine, it also seems to help me focus when I'm writing. So, yes, I thought I'd treat the Grelian engineering staff to a glass of Ruby Porto tonight.
Well, have you heard? There's a new study. The scientific community is going back on their statement that red wine has health benefits.
Every five minutes,
it seems like they go back and forth. They're catering to the lobbyists, in my opinion, but... This newest study, I believe it's out of Berkeley, says, and this is specifically for women, red wine in moderate amounts, while it will help reduce your risk of heart disease, the risk of increase in breast cancer outweighs the benefit of the reduce of heart disease.
See, here's the thing, and what people have to keep in mind when it comes to the potential benefits versus the detriments of alcohol consumption, there are, first of all, it's different for men. Okay, and for women. I think that in general, while red wine is antioxidant rich and, you know, moderate consumption, especially for men, has been shown scientifically to have a lot of health benefits. In women, yes, there is a heightened risk in many instances of breast cancer, which is correlated with alcohol consumption. But now there are also studies that show, and this is what people need to keep in mind, studies also show that if you drink too much, okay, if you consume too much alcohol, there are negative, okay, effects. There are detrimental effects that one can incur on their health. Get this. Now, in addition to the negative effects that are associated with overconsumption of alcohol, if you don't consume alcohol at all, there are similar effects. Did you know that?
Yes, I actually read a study, and it's what I used to... I guess combat the closed-mindedness of the teetotalers who like to condemn me for tippling, and it says not just not drinking at all, but moderate alcohol consumption versus light alcohol consumption. Light alcohol consumption is detrimental, but moderate to heavy alcohol consumption, not, you know, drink a whole bottle of bourbon in a night, but, you know, moderate being a glass or two a night. My definition of heavy being 2 to 3 to 4 libations an evening, twice
more,
a week,
yeah.
3 times a week, something like that. Moderate to, you know, lightly heavy drinking is better for you than light drinking.
Yeah, in other words, all things in moderation. That seems to be the key here. Now, again, like I said, you know, these potential benefits and negative effects differ, you know, between the sexes and also between age groups and the like. But one thing that cannot be disputed is that indeed, by virtue of the ingredients that go into especially red wine, you know, it is indeed antioxidant rich, and it can have a lot of potential health benefits. And that a little wine every now and then, you know, or moderate, and actually a lot of these studies that I've read with regard to alcohol consumption don't just deal solely exclusively with wine. I mean, really, when it comes to the consumption of alcohol, they usually describe even cocktails and mixed drinks and you know, moderate consumption being maybe 3 to 5 beverages or so a week. But again, I think that, you know, men seem to benefit more from that than women do. And yeah, like you pointed out, Chris, those studies, okay, we don't want to give that kind of nebulous, they say, the scientific establishment says, because that's not an individual. These individual studies, on the other hand, are released by different organizations at different times, and they tend to kind of be cyclical in the sense that, you know, one week they'll be saying, oh, you know, the benefits of wine, and then the next week it'll be, oh, the detriments of wine, you know, or alcohol in general.
I just got to say, this whole topic makes me think of an episode of Cheers I saw forever ago where I can't remember what character it was, but they're sitting at the bar and somebody asks them, like, why do you drink so much or whatever. I think it was Woody Harrelson.
Then Hank Williams Jr. breaks through the wall and goes, to get drunk!
Well, ideally that's what would have happened, but what... I think it was Woody Harrelson who said it. They ask him why he drank so much, and he says, well, it's the buffalo theory.
And how does the buffalo theory go?
I say, what's the buffalo theory? Well, he says, you know, you watch these nature shows and stuff, and you see when a herd of buffalo are grazing on the plain or something, a predator comes and tries to pick one off for food, and which one is it picking off? The weakest of the herd.
Okay.
And therefore, overall, strengthening the herd.
Ah.
So that's the whole theory, is that by drinking heavily, you're killing brain cells and things like that, but...
The weakest among them are going to die first.
You're killing the weakest brain cells. Therefore, overall, strengthening the brain.
Ah, so alcohol consumption, therefore, we also know now, is conducive to, you know, enriching your brain function. No wonder we're so intelligent here on the Graylian Report, right? Chris, you're a smart fella.
I'm probably the smartest fella.
Yeah, well, I guess,
honestly.
Well, we can't measure that in accordance with your alcohol consumption, right?
We should.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, let's save it for the next break. I think you got another startling story for us when we come back. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. Stay with us.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
This is the sound of a flat-screen television hurled off a building. Now the new bike your kid wants. These are the things you could have, all cast into oblivion. Because when you throw away money on wasted electricity, you throw away everything you could have bought with it. Use Energy Star light bulbs and appliances, and you could save hundreds of dollars a year. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to your home for right and reason in an unreasonable world. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your mouth of the South, Micah Hanks. Hearing some of the sounds of Mac Maloney's new Sky Club release. Mac Maloney is not only a musician, he also happens, get this, to be a ufologist. And he's going to be joining us in December, December 6th, actually, here on the Grailian Report to discuss his latest offering to the UFO community. We're looking forward to having Mac on the program, and so we're featuring a little of his music here tonight on the program. I'm sure we'll probably be featuring more of it when he actually joins us as a guest as well. But that said, welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. It is your weekly Grailian Report. Everyone likes, well, I hope everyone likes a Grailian Report. I know a few people like the Grailian Report. And I can tell you where the evidence for that comes from. The numbers that continue to grow out there in radio land. That's right. People downloading the program. You know, it's most popular still in its podcast form. And I think that that's where the general radio listenership is these days. I think there's this conception among a lot of people in the industry. And I worked in radio professionally for a number of years myself. And there's this, what I'd actually call a misconception that, you know, if you're going to do radio, damn it, you got to do it live. Well, I love doing live radio too. I mean, I think that that's the ideal circumstance. But the thing is that the podcast is such a unique circumstance. It allows people to listen on demand at their convenience, you know, whenever they want to get around to listening to something. And although, you know, it removes the ability for one to call into a program, you know, and ask Matt if he's single or not, it nonetheless is a very interesting circumstance where you can enjoy a program and you can listen to it as often as you want to or as little as you want to. And, you know, and I think that that's kind of the way of the future. This is one of the big things when I worked in radio. See, I don't work in radio now. This is independent news that you are listening to right now. And that's why we love it so much and why we love being able to spend 3 hours with you every week here on the Grailian Report. You know, we're not being told by our program directors. I'll tell you, my program director is sitting right next to me, and this guy and I are probably as close to being on the same page as anyone I know. Our wonderful producer, Chris Hayes, works very hard. So does the Reverend back here on the Master Console. These guys work as hard as I do in providing compelling content, and there's not some corporate entity that's breathing down our neck telling us what we can and cannot say. And I'm not trying to demonize corporations. You know, I'm not that guy. That ain't me, boss. But what I am is someone who will tell you the truth as often as I can, and in this medium, this independent medium, we are better able to do that for you. Whether you're listening to us live right now, or if you're catching the recorded podcast a couple of days after the fact, that you can download and enjoy and take with you and listen to over and over and over again. But I'll tell you what, here's what I do know. The podcast downloads reflect one hell of a growing body of people, not just here in the United States, but worldwide, who are listening to this program. And we thank every one of you for continuing to support and enjoy this program. There are a lot of donations that have been received recently. People continue to donate to the Grailian Report and to help us out. Our friend Leslie, I just saw that. You can't slip one by me. Our good friend Leslie in Tennessee just sent a donation just while we were on the broad, right here doing this live broadcast, talking to you right now. You know, that warms our heart and moves us incredibly. You have no idea how much that means to us. And if you're listening to this program, if you do want to contribute to the Grailian Report and help us out, you know, you don't have to make a donation. You can send us an email. Tell us what you'd like to hear more about on the program. You can share a story, like that remarkable UFO story we had from the last hour. But if you are so inclined to make a monetary donation to help, help us ward off the haters. No, not really. No, I tell you what it is to continue to improve the broadcast. We have to pay server costs, not just for the website, of course. You know, did you see, by the way, we got linked to Coast to Coast AM yesterday again? Yeah, that's the thing, is that, you know, with popularity also comes the necessity for being able to continue to provide, you know, to the masses. And I think we had well over 5,000. We had close to 6,000 visitors to the website just yesterday alone. So that's pretty remarkable in itself. And the thing is that, you know, as you get more and more popular, and bandwidth and bitrate and all these things are taken into consideration, you know, that's not just for the website. We're talking about also for a live stream, which we're going to improve literally within the next few weeks. I can tell you that more as it develops. But, and then the podcast itself as well, server space for storage for that. All these things do take money, time, resources, and all that, and that's why we're so thankful for folks who sponsor this program and those also who make donations and help us grow the program. But when we grow the program, we want to grow it in ways that are beneficial and helpful to you. I think communication is key, and I think also that, you know, growing and learning together as people is important. And that is what, with this medium, we want to try and do. The Graylian Report, it's important to us to be able to help you and to provide you with things that are both entertaining and a good release from the daily grind and from the work week, but also things that are insightful and that can help you and that can help us all to grow and learn together and enrich our experience here as humans on terra firma, or under terra firma if you're like us, your weekly Graylians. And that said, we appreciate your donations. They're easy to make. You can visit www.graylianreport.com, and right in the middle column at the top of the page, you'll see a PayPal donate button. Click right there. It's made simple. There aren't any minimum requirements. You can donate a dollar if you want to, but every little bit helps, and we appreciate everyone who continues to donate and help make this program better on a week-to-week basis. That said, we've got a really, really bizarre story, but I think that the implications of this story are important, and that's why I want producer Chris Hayes to touch on this for a moment, because it has to do with regeneration of limbs.
Yes, this article is from the mirror.co.uk. It's dated it's dated today, the 8th of November. I'm sorry.
It's coming to us fresh and hot off the skillet.
I'm bad at dates. It's actually dated 8:05 p.m. That's probably UK time, though, so. But the article is entitled, Woman Had Gigantic 5-Stone Leg Amputated. For all of our American listeners who don't know conversions, a stone is about 10 pounds. So 5 stones would be 50 pounds. A 50-pound leg was amputated from this woman, but it started growing back. Yes, that's right. Mandy Sellers had one of her gigantic legs amputated when doctors warned her that the limb would kill her. But 22 months after the operation, it's growing back at an alarming rate.
Now, when they say that the leg is growing back, I mean, obviously, this is what would be more likely called an appendage. I mean, there's not like, you know, a foot or anything like that growing, right?
Yet.
Right.
No, there's no foot, and there's no indication in the article whether or not the bone is growing back as well, or if it's just, you know, like a muscular tumor. But Mandy, who's 36 years old, she suffers from a rare disease, meaning that she has a normal-sized body but massive feet and legs. Her left leg, which had weighed about 50 pounds, led to serious infections. She got septicemia in the limb, and the doctors warned her that it was either her or the leg. Excuse me. But after the op, it began ballooning again. It now weighs 3 stone, or 30 pounds, and has a circumference of 1 meter.
Oh, wow.
Mandy had said that she hoped the amputation would stabilize her condition, but she thinks that, in her heart, she knew that it would start growing again. Almost straight away, the lump began increasing in circumference, and she was finding it harder to fit into her prosthetic leg. And then the stump grew so heavy that it broke her prosthetic leg. This ex-RSPCA voluntary worker suffers from a condition similar to Proteus syndrome, which is the illness that is thought to have affected elephant man Joseph Merrick in the 19th century.
My name is John Merrick.
But Mandy, who's from, oh, English names, looks like Accrington Lancaster, is hopeful that a cure can be found, and she said, I'll not let this thing beat me. I'm determined to stay as mobile as possible and fight for my independence. I just have to live day to day, week to week. I've got a life, and I have to live it as best as I can. There are people far worse off than me. So even though she's dealing with this horrible, disfiguring disease, I mean, it's no slight against her, but I mean, to imagine your legs, just your legs and feet being 3 times the size of the rest of your body.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's... I'd say anyone with that is having a bad day and legitimately has a reason to gripe, but... She's in such good spirits that, you know, she says, you know, yeah, this sucks, but other people are way worse than me, so I'm going to get through it, and I'm not going to whine.
What an inspiring story, truly. That is truly inspiring. You know, so many people, I mean, even today, I should just go ahead and put the disclaimer out here. I'm so thrilled and privileged to be able to do this program on a weekly basis. I enjoy it so much. This is the highlight of my week. And I was moping around earlier today, even in the back of my head, telling myself I'm going to be doing the show tonight and connecting with, you know, thousands of people around the globe, on the web, with the Graylian Report. And yet I still feel under the weather. And stories like hers remind me that I have nothing to gripe about. And yet, here she is, maintaining optimism. She literally had a leg amputated, and it has begun to grow back, or some semblance of a appendage has begun to grow back, and she is remaining entirely optimistic. That is truly, truly remarkable, inspiring, and even enlightening in the sense. You know, it reminds us that, you know, hey, we all could be so much worse off, and what we really need to do is remind ourselves day to day that we are so thankful. We should be thankful, I'm sorry, for what we have. We should be thankful for what we have not. We should be thankful for what we're able to do, where we're able to go, the food we're able to eat. Not everybody has what we do. We have it pretty good, you know. And however bad and how downtrodden you may feel like you're getting in life, you know, somebody out there probably has it worse. You know, we have so much to be thankful for.
Is that why you keep telling me to be more optimistic about Chris making more than me?
Well, he makes more than you right now because, hold on, I think that's an accounting issue. Hang on.
I only make more than you on the days you're not here.
Well, I don't think Steve's in the office at this hour.
Yeah, that's true.
But I can't account for that. Are you grapping again? Wait a minute.
No, I was just asking.
Hey, can you put a lid on
question?
It? I was just... Hey,
you know,
really?
if you guys want to continue sidetracking from the story, I had another point. But, you know, whatever. No, I don't need to say it.
I was making an inspirational speech, Chris.
No, I'm talking about the whole blah, 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 Chris gets paid more than me thing.
Who brought it up? Oh, yeah, he did.
This guy. This guy right here. He's so selfish. You know what? You should just be thankful for the experience. I sold my soul to the... No. Listen to this. There is a case of a man who sold his soul to the devil, and he didn't get anything from it. He was just told that it would be good experience. He was an intern, yes, but at least you're not an intern.
I'm not the devil, Chris.
I mean, our interns go through a lot.
Our interns do go through a lot. But anyway, back to the story of the 50 stone leg.
It's like a parable now.
Okay.
It is a parable. But her attitude, Wendy's attitude throughout the whole ordeal she's going through reminds me of something the late, great George Carlin said. That he never feels, you know, even though he was an angry, angry man and it was hilarious, he never felt that personally, you know, as far as his own health, he could gripe because he had what he called the plus a headache rule.
Okay.
Where, yeah, this guy has cancer, a broken leg, no arms, and a horn growing out of his neck. But someone else has cancer, one leg, no arms, and a horn growing out of his neck, and a headache. Who's worse off?
You know, yeah, George Carlin was a wise guy. He also said things
can always get worse.
He was wise beyond his probably beyond his physicality. You know, he also said incredible things like this. If it's true that our species is alone in the universe, then I'd have to say that the universe aimed rather low and settled for very little. That's George Carlin right there. But anywho, you know, that is an inspiring story, Chris. Thank you for sharing that with us, even though I think initially you were concerned that it was going to be too gross to discuss on the air.
Well, just initially, I'm gonna tell you, you know, we'll put it in the show notes. I'll give it to Micah to put in the show notes. But the pictures initially, you know, as I was skimming the article before the show, the pictures kind of freaked me out.
That's insensitive, Chris.
I know it's insensitive, but I can't help my gut reaction.
You fear the things that you don't understand.
I fear massive legs.
Massive legs.
Like the idea of a limb growing back. I mean, that's lizards do that.
Well, yeah, or reptilians. Wait.
What
are your thoughts on that? You know, I'm waiting tonight. You know, normally we're getting flooded with text messages and things like that. And you know what? Tonight I haven't received a single text message. So go ahead and get your pen and paper ready. I'll give you a second. Let's twiddle our thumbs for a moment, guys, while people get pen and paper. Because I want you to write this down. This is the number where you can send us text messages here at the Graylian Report. You know, I mean, I always say while we're on the air, but really, I guess I shouldn't abuse this. But the truth is if you wanted to send us text messages throughout the week, you could probably do that just as well. I mean, if you wanted to. And here's that number. It's 828-367-7201. If you want to send us a text message, tell us what you think about that. Inspiring? Frightening? The kind of story you'd like to hear more on the program or not? I find it very inspiring. I find it very, very, almost invigorating, you know, that in the face of adversity, people can pick up and say, you know what, we could be worse off. And that's so often the case. But that said, now, something else we teased about earlier, this is another story. There's another claim now that the Patterson-Gimlin film is a hoax. And Matt may not have known what the thing was. I'm just kidding. No, Matt knows exactly what it is. Matt, hey, why don't you give us a little background? Tell us what the Patterson-Gimlin film is. Don't get too in detail here. Just generally.
It's like the...
That thing.
Oh, my that God. One. Really?
Let him talk, Chris.
No, it's like the staple Bigfoot flick. You know,
exactly.
I mean, if you've ever seen Bigfoot with, like, the swinging arms and everything, you've seen Patterson-Gimlin footage.
A lot of people don't realize that when they're seeing that famous photograph of the Sasquatch in mid-stride, that was actually taken from a film purported to be a real film from 1968, I believe, in Bluff Creek, California, filmed by a man named Roger Patterson along with his associate Bob Gimlin, and they claimed that it was a real Bigfoot. They'd been traveling up around Bluff Creek, the aforementioned location in Northern California. And as they were traveling along, Bob and Roger, riding along on horseback, had been carrying a small 16mm color camera with them. And so they ride, as they're riding along, they come to this area where I think there'd been some heavy rain that summer, and kind of an area, there was like a sandbar where a creek had kind of washed out an entire area. And there, crouched by the river, according to the story, was this large creature. Obviously very man-like, except this was no man, according to what even can be seen in the film, even if it's a suit being worn by someone. Someone did a very good job designing what can only be described as breasts. There are large female breasts on the creature in the Patterson-Gimlin film, and that's pretty easily discernible in the film. But now, of course, there's always that chance that it's not real. In fact, in all likelihood, I think we would have to say that the likely explanation here is that this thing, whatever it is not a Bigfoot. It's something, you know, along the lines of a person in a suit. And there have been people come forward over the years who've said this. There was one man, a retired Pepsi Cola bottler from Yakima, Washington, named Bob Hieronymus. Not the same Bob Hieronymus who happens to host a esoteric radio program.
And not Hieronymus Bosch?
No, not that one either. No, this Mr. Hieronymus claims that indeed it was a suit and that he was the man who was hired by Roger Patterson to wear it, but that he said that the suit was made of horse hide and that it stunk in the heat as he was walking along there in Bluff Creek wearing it. I have to say that suit looked pretty darn good to be horse hide sewn together. But by the same token, and this is where it gets really interesting, there's also a costume maker who lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. I think he's still in business to this day. He too claims that it was a costume, but it wasn't horsehide. He says it was one of his own creations and that he sold the suit to Roger Patterson. Now, Roger Patterson, of course, passed away. He died of cancer just a few years after the film was made and after the film made him famous. But to this day, his associate, Bob Gimlin, who is still alive, maintains that whatever it was that they filmed that day was indeed alive, it was real. Bob said that he had his gun, he had a rifle with him as they were traveling on horseback, and he said that although Roger Patterson was thrown from his horse, which was startled when this creature appeared, he said that Patterson jumped up and ran with the camera and managed to capture all this famous footage of this creature walking away into the brush. But Mr. Gimlin said that while his associate was filming, he said, "I had my gun drawn on that creature, the rifle pointed directly at it." He said, "When we came up on it, you know, it's silent footage, you don't hear anything, okay, but," he says, "what we heard was this thing growled at us, and it was not happy that we were there, and this thing looked at us like it could have stared a hole right through us, and it got up and it stomped off into the bushes. You see the thing walking away in the film, but," he said, "you don't hear the growl, you don't smell the odor that this creature gave off that we smelled," and he said that if that was a person in a suit, and Roger knew about it, and I didn't, that person very well likely could have died that day, because he said, "I had my gun drawn ready to fire had it turned on us and attacked." And to this day, now I'm paraphrasing again, I'm not reading his actual testimony, but you know, these are the sorts of things that Gimlin has said over the years, and he maintains to this day that indeed this creature in the film is not a person in a suit, and that his late associate, Mr. Patterson, indeed filmed a Bigfoot, a real Bigfoot. A large, human-like, but hair-covered, primitive, one of many supposed to exist throughout the Pacific Northwest and other parts of the United States as well. But this new website, and it's got an interesting and rather compelling title, it's pgfhoax.blogspot.com. PGF, what does that stand for?
I couldn't...
Let's see.
Paper... Paper graph fixture?
Purple green.
Isn't that the golf thing? PGF?
PGF. Oh, yeah. I think Matt's got a lead right there.
Yeah.
Purple grape?
Fire? Let's see. Pound for goblins.
You're out of order.
I got them wrong. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Pound goblin fours? No. Anyway, I guess that's
irrelevant. Who's the guy that shot... Who was it that shot the movie? Because I don't even know what the movie's called. I just know it's the big
Roger Patterson, but it's Roger PGF, Patterson. Not R, like Roger.
Yeah. Patterson.
Did he have a buddy with him?
Was there someone else?
Yeah.
There was a person there. Anyway, okay, that's irrelevant. Yeah. The point is that the Patterson-Gimlin film, according to this website, is a hoax and it is proven. That's what they're saying, at least. You know what? This is too good. When we come back, we're going to touch on that. We're going to go ahead and go to the break right now. Pay the bills so we can come back and spend a minute talking about this. Indeed, there are many who have claimed over the years that this thing is a fake, but there is dirt on both sides, both the claims of the filmmakers and those who have said that they have faked it over the years. We'll read what this latest claim has to say about it, and then we'll go into some of our own notes about this famous film. I'm Micah Hanks. It is The Graylian Report.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomenon, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Hi, Bob Tarmac from InceptionRadioNetwork.com. I want to clue you into a show that I listen to every single week. It's Inception Radio with Jamie Hannigan. It airs Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Jamie always brings on new guests every single week on a variety of topics. UFOs, it's paranormal, it's time travel, conspiracy theory, it's everything. And Jamie covers it in depth. When this begins, Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you then.
Hey guys, Jamie Havigan here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out and keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havigan.
Join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
It's funny because I'm getting emails during the break here from folks saying, you know, I never noticed the female parts on that thing in the film. You know? Well, if you look at it, no, it's true. If you look at the Patterson-Gimlin film, it's quite evident that whatever it was in the film was a girl. It was a lady, if it was real. Of course, it very well may have been a suit. And that is the claim being made right now at a new website, PGF Hoax. You know, there we go, PGF.
You got it?
No, I lost it. I had it.
It's purple grape fire. It's what we're drinking.
Purple
grape. It's purple grape fire. Oh. Wine is a hoax. Don't drink it.
Wine is a hoax. We figured it out. You know, I would have probably stewed on that for I would have even patted on that for a whole week.
I'm going to perpetuate the wine hoax, though. You know, I'm going to keep it alive.
Keep it alive, Matt.
So
finally,
just,
Matt
just
Oakley.
So everyone else needs to be safe. To be safe, don't ever drink any more wine. Any wine you were going to drink, send to us. We will take the bullet for
exactly,
you.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're
going to
take
gonna,
one
I'm
for
gonna...
the paranormal team.
Hey, that would be nice, though. You know, anyone in the listening audience, if you can't afford to make a donation to the Graylian Report, but you want to mail us a bottle of wine, that's fine, too.
Or any kind of arboreal alcoholic.
No. Stop him right
only
there.
Wine. Everything else is true. Wine is a hoax.
Just
don't
to show that
it.
We are real.
Well, I'll give you my personal address.
Did we ask for your personal... Okay, go ahead.
No, it's okay.
No, I wanted to get to this thing about the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Well, fine. Do it.
Would you put a lid
see
on
if
it?
I care.
Okay, fine. Matt lives at one jerk face away. Okay, there we go. Let's talk about the film.
Now a girl's going to be going to his house, you know, trying to find out if he's still single. I don't think he will be single after this week's broadcast. But anyway.
Not pretty sure I still will be.
So he is single. What about Alexa?
No,
what
I didn't
to Alexa?
Say that.
Yeah, you did. You definitely.
No, it's
you
the
definitely...
wine.
No, that's a hoax, Matt. Everybody knows that.
Was it?
What do you think? What do you think about this film?
About me being single?
Matt, would you put a lid on it for just a minute? I'm talking to the listeners now. What do people out there think about Bigfoot? Is this film completely a hoax? Is it real? You know, and it's interesting to me. This thing was made, if I remember correctly, this was 1968. Decades later, we are still wondering whether it was a man in a monkey suit, a monkey suit that happened to have mammary organs. Or was it real? Well, a real Sasquatch. What you think, what you know, and what you can prove are often very different scenarios. As this the author at this new pgfhoax.blogspot.com website has said, this is especially true when concerning the Patterson-Gimlin film of an alleged Sasquatch or Bigfoot. It was October 20th. Oh, I was wrong. It was 1967. Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin claimed to have captured film of a Bigfoot-type creature and documented part of its trackaway along with making plaster casts of the imprints left by the film suspect. The blogger here writes, I'm claiming that during the footage of Patterson casting a track, there should be an impression visible past the one he is casting, but there is not. During the footage showing four impressions, there is now a footprint present past the one Patterson was casting previously. The ground in the footage of Patterson making the cast shows flat mud and no impression. No following track present. I'm also identifying the two scenes as one in the same location and impression. The right impression being cast. Okay, anyway, breaking this all down, essentially what we're talking about here is that there are scenes that Patterson filmed following the famous footage of this alleged creature walking along where some of the footprints left in the sand are visible and casts are being made. The blogger goes on to write, it is not coincidence that Krantz, talking about Grover Krantz, who was a well-known anthropologist back in the day who took interest in Bigfoot, it's not a coincidence that Krantz documents Patterson's actions just by wild chance. On page 32 of Big Footprints by Grover Krantz, Krantz writes, the shape of a footprint can be dug into the ground with the fingers and or a hand tool, the interior pressed flat, and it can then be photographed or cast in plaster. My first footprint cast was made by a student in just this manner. Roger Patterson told me he did this once in order to get a movie of himself pouring a plaster cast for the documentary he was making. A few days later, he filmed the actual Sasquatch. Now, this is what is known. Apparently, Roger Patterson, being something of an entrepreneurial type, had hoped to make a documentary about Bigfoot. It is understood probably that when he purchased a Bigfoot costume from a costume maker, a monkey suit, if you will, from a costume maker in Charlotte, North Carolina, that he had been buying this suit for use in a documentary he was filming. I think, if I recall correctly, that Patterson even said this. Krantz's documentation of this also places Patterson making fake tracks at Bluff Creek and making a film of it. The case of the missing print. How ironic is it that Patterson filmed proof of his own hoax? And they go on to show some of these photographs that Patterson allegedly made. And the blogger, again, who goes by the name River, writes that this is proof that the Patterson-Gimlin film is a hoax. This is not speculation, nor is it condemnation. This isn't about my opinion or yours or any accredited scientists. The evidence is right there on the film. Patterson and Gimlin did what no one else has been able to do since. He writes, "Don't hate, I appreciate the legend and the story that has become famous worldwide, but instead of bashing Patterson and Gimlin, I thank them for the entertainment and for accomplishing one of the best hoaxes in our time." But now the thing is that if indeed they were knowingly perpetrating a hoax, or rather knowingly filming a documentary about Bigfoot. See, the thing is that it seems that Gimlin, or rather Patterson probably more likely, made certain distinctions. And I'm not necessarily trying to say that the film is real, but what I am saying is that if it was a hoax, he had apparently made distinctions between what he filmed at Bluff Creek, which he claimed was a real creature, and then what he had allegedly bought this Bigfoot suit for, which was to make a, or to aid in making a documentary. Now, there are a few interesting things about the suit. I've already pointed out that there are varying, conflicting accounts regarding who actually wore the suit, where the suit came from, and then there are also these circumstances surrounding, then this is one of the big problems with the film. The film, I believe, was filmed, it says on October 20th, 1967, but if I remember correctly, that was early in the afternoon on a Friday. And somehow, by the following, I think actually by that weekend sometime, the film had been produced and was available upon request to a radio station in the area that interviewed Patterson and Gimlin. Again, I'm not reading, you know, something about this, so some of the details may be fuzzy, but the gist of the story was that I know that they did appear on a radio program just within a couple of days, and they had had a copy of the film prepared already. Now, the question is, how does one get film developed on a Friday afternoon if they were out in the woods at around 1 or 2 o'clock? How do they get back to civilization in time to be able to get that film developed?
There's a reason it's called one-hour film developing. Whether it's a roll of 35mm just still photography film or 8mm. What was this shot on, 16mm or Super 8?
16.
16mm. The process is virtually identical. With movie film, it's basically the same technology as color slide photography film, where that's differentiated from regular film. In the color slide film, when you develop it into a negative, it is the it's basically in the negative frame, it's the right colors, it's not inverted.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, anywhere where there is a portable darkroom, darkrooms are deceptively easy to set up, you could develop the film in a couple of hours.
Okay. And what they actually said had happened, as I understand it, was that this film had essentially, been made, and then it was taken to a private laboratory or something along those lines, and that's how they were able to get the film developed as quickly as they did. So it's interesting because there was a book that was put out a few years ago claiming that this entire thing had been a hoax. I think Greg Long was one of the authors who had interviewed people describing Patterson, quote, as a liar, a con man, and sometimes worse. So, Roger Patterson wasn't really considered one of the most reputable individuals. But by the same token, Gimlin, who, get this, he's the associate again who had, you know, had the gun trained on this thing during the alleged encounter. Gimlin had always said he doubted that Sasquatch creatures might exist. But he also agreed that they probably shouldn't attempt to shoot these things unless they presented any kind of danger to them. And according to Grover Krantz, years later, Patterson and Gimlin agreed that they should have tried to shoot the creature after the fact, knowing what they were looking at, but that they decided that, you know, while they were there, as long as it wasn't causing them any harm, they shouldn't shoot it. And that's something that a lot of people have said. If you guys were armed with guns and you knew you had this thing right there in front of you, and you could have literally made history with this film, well, why didn't you just shoot the thing? Why didn't you kill it? That would have settled the whole dispute. You would have had what, you know, everyone has always wanted, which is proof, a physical body of a Bigfoot. But the thing is, and this is the key, and this is what I have to say, there are many reports by individuals over the years who have said, yes, you know what, it was right there in front of me. I saw it. But the thing was so damned human, there's nothing that I could have done. I couldn't have killed it. It would have been like taking the life of a human being. And I don't know what that thing is in the video. In all likelihood, it's a person wearing some sort of a costume, but if it isn't, on the outside chance that it is an actual Bigfoot-type creature, it's walking upright, it looks damn human to me. I'm a human, I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
Want to have some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. On the Inception Radio Network.com. We'll see you there.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
We are not mere men, we are mutants. And we're keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Micah Hanks, joined by the friendly Graylian neighborhood staff here, because there are apparently staffers all around the Moho neighborhood down here, deep within the recesses of the Hollow Earth where we function on a weekly basis. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, with Chris Hayes and the Reverend Matt Oakley. We've been talking about this Patterson-Gimlin film. which years and years after being made of an alleged living relic hominid, a Sasquatch, there's still a lot of questions with regard to whether it is real or not. Now, for most people, it's pretty obvious. It's a fake. But there have been a lot out there who have maintained that indeed the film is authentic. And although I try and suspend my disbelief as well as my belief, I'll tell you this. There have always been a lot of questions about that film that have made me wonder, including some of the anatomical aspects pertaining to the film and some of the details contained therein. And I'll just tell you this. Although there's a lot of things that have come up over the years, or there have been a lot of things that have either been conducive to proving its authenticity or the hoax, you know, what many again claim to be an obvious hoax. You know, I don't know if Bigfoot exists. I don't know what the hell the thing is in the footage. But I'll tell you this. This latest evidence, this proof positive that what we're seeing is a hoax, it's just like so many previous similar claims. I don't see anything that is, again, offering conclusive evidence that these Bigfoot creatures do or do not exist. I don't know what the situation with the film is. I don't know whether Roger Patterson was a con man, you know, or if indeed they managed to capture something remarkable on film that afternoon in 1967. But what I do know is that the debate continues, and despite what is being said right now about that film, I think that the debate for many will continue, as it has already for so many decades. But that said, moving right along, you know, I said we are mutants. We are mutants. But not just here in the studio. I think a lot of people, they probably don't realize, but we may be humans as we know it because of mutations that occurred a long, long time ago. You know, there's the ancient alien theory about all this.
Hey, Micah, real quick, just
coming. We have breaking news here in the Moho.
Well, coming from the chat room, Red Pill Junkie, Dallas Reese, and Leslie have all brought up something called Zana or Zana. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing this wrong. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard of it. I don't know why I asked, you know, what it was, because I have access to Google. Apparently, you know, I don't know if you know anything about this. Let me read what RPJ is saying about it. The story goes that in the XIXth, which, okay, fine, 19th century, a female Almas or Russian Yeti was captured. And it was said that some of the villagers mated with Zana or Zana, and it resulted in a few hybrid babies. Are you familiar with this at all?
I am actually somewhat familiar with this story. There are
this
a number
is weird, wild stuff, man.
This is some weird, wild stuff. There are a number of stories, you know, from the you know, what are called Almas or Almasti, and alleged you know, captives that have been taken. You know, in parts of Russia and the like, you know, relic hominids, human-like big creatures that have been captured and kept in captivity. Now, one such story, and I actually managed to pull up the Wikipedia page on the what are called the Almas, which are essentially kind of a Russian, you know, version or a Mongolian version of the Bigfoot creature here known in the United States. Zana was an alleged wild woman said to have lived in the isolated mountain village of Tikhinya, 50 miles south of Sukhumi, in Abkhazia, in the Caucasus. I hope I pronounced all that right. Some have speculated that she may have been an Almas, but hard evidence, as is often the case, is very lacking. Now, the story goes that there was this female creature, very similar to, I guess, what we would see in the Patterson-Gimlin film, that was captured in the mountains there in this region in 1850. She was at first violent toward her captors, but eventually became a little bit more docile, even domesticated, and indeed was able to even assist with simple household chores. Zana is said to have had sexual relations with a man of the village named Edgy Ginaba, and gave birth to a number of children of apparently normal human appearance, little Ginabas, that were half human, half, well, whatever Zana was.
Did they have disproportionate strength?
You know, well, I'm not sure here. It says that several of the children died in their infancy. That some commentators have attributed these early deaths to Zana's genetic incompatibility with humans. And keeping in mind, you know, we've talked about humanzies and human ape hybrids on this program in the past. I don't think that it's conclusive that, you know, humans could interbreed or whether they could or could not interbreed with chimpanzees.
Now, I don't know if I buy that whole, you know, there were offspring, but then they died.
Well, I don't think all of them died.
It just well, some started. Of them died due to, you know, not being genetically compatible. When in biology, basically, if you're not genetically compatible, you're not going to produce offspring. The only thing you could kind of use to refute that is, you know, mules or something along the lines of ligers. Yes, they exist. Mules being, you know, the offspring of a horse and a donkey, but, you know, being basically unable to reproduce at a genetically inviable offspring, basically. But not something that's born and then dies because it's genetically incompatible.
Yeah, Micah, haven't you ever heard that Loverboy song, pig and elephant DNA just won't splice?
No, man, you can make a pig with four butts, you can make an elephant with four butts, but pig and elephant DNA just don't splice.
Yeah, pot-bellied elephants cannot be created.
That's enlightening, fellas. You know, you learn something every week. Well. Anyway, Mr. Ganaba, the father, you know, who had gotten to know Zana in the biblical sense, allegedly gave away four of these children to families in the area. The two boys, Zanda and Kuit Ganaba, and then the two girls, Kodzanar and Gamasa, were assimilated into normal society. They married. They had families of their own. Now, Zana, the alleged Almas, herself passed away in 1890. The skull of Kuit is still, or actually it's probably pronounced Kvit, is still around. And I think there was actually a popular television program that actually showed the alleged remains of you know, or some of Kvit's remains. It was examined by, guess who? Of course, the late anthropologist Dr. Grover Krantz, who we mentioned during the last hour, back in the early 1990s, and he pronounced it to be entirely modern, with no Neanderthal features at all. If Krantz's verdict on the skull is correct, this is coming according to Wikipedia, if Krantz's verdict on the skull is correct and the skull itself is indeed that of Zana's son, it would indicate that Zana may have been a member of an isolated hunter-gatherer tribe so culturally different from her captor society as to make Zana seem non-human to them, but even she was indeed a modern human. How this may relate to the true identity of other reported Almases is unknown. But there's another case from 1941, shortly after the German invasion into the USSR, where an alleged wild man was captured somewhere in the same region. And this was by a detachment of the Red Army. This man, again, appeared to be human, but was covered in fine, dark hair. Now, they attempted to interrogate him, you know. He was kept in a room, and I think that they'd said that despite the fact that he was only wearing fur, that he sweated profusely and things like this. He had the apparent inability, they said, or perhaps unwillingness to speak. They said that the creature had, was said to have been shot because they were afraid he was some sort of a German spy. There are various versions of this legend in cryptozoological literature, and as with other Almas reports, hard proof is typically absent. That one sounds a lot more to me, of course, like an urban legend that's kind of built up around the Sasquatch myth. And, you know, there are a lot of those. But, and actually, tell you the truth, if I can find it, there's a fantastic story that I think comes from Ireland from back, oh gosh, this would have probably been in the 1500s. We'll have to dig around and see if we can find that. But this story, I've taken a certain interest in what I would call woodwosses, and we've written about these a good bit at the Grailian Report. And actually, you know what? I here it is. I've actually found the story. These woodwosses are essentially European descriptions of wild men. They're reported from time to time. And I put a piece up back in March of this year called "Fear and Folk Devilry in Ireland: A 13th Century Wild Man." Let me just read this encounter for you. This appeared in a 13th century document called the King's Mirror. It was written around 1250 believed to have been authored in Norway. And though various translations do still exist, the one available online which we sourced for this article was translated from the Old Norwegian by Lawrence Marcellus Larsen back in 1917. Now, there are many curiosities that are referenced throughout this text, you know, described as wonders of Ireland. And one of these sections, subtitled The Natural Wonders of Ireland, features the following rather strange account of a beast, apparently manlike, that was captured sometime prior to the authorship. It goes like this. Once it happened in that country, and this seems indeed strange, that a living creature was caught in the forest as to which no one could say definitely whether it was a man or some other animal. For no one could get a word from it or be sure that it understood human speech. It had the human shape, however, in every detail, both as to hands and face and feet, but the entire body was covered with hair, as the beasts are, and down the back it had a long, coarse mane like that of a horse, which fell to both sides and trailed along the ground when the creature stooped in walking. So that's the story, and I think it's pretty interesting. Now, one of the comments that was left by one of the readers was that while the source is indeed authentic, it's difficult to say any tradition or find any tradition, generally, of Irish wild men other than this report, keeping in mind that the authorship of the document had been in Norway in the 1200s. An exception might be the Grugach. This word is variously translated as giant, ogre, magician, and it may have been derived from the Irish word of Grugalg, which means hare. These creatures turn up in folk stories, but not usually in accounts of encounters with Bigfoot-type creatures, and they should not be confused with the female long-haired Grugach of Scottish folklore. The Irish-type Grugach turns up in Scottish folklore also. Ronan Coghlan wrote that at the Grailian Report in response to the article. I always found that very interesting, too. But then there is the story of, and I believe he's called the Grey Man of Ben McDooey. See if we can pull up the information about that, because this is something, I don't know if you're familiar with this book, and if you haven't read it, you really should look into it. Lauren Coleman and Mark A. Hall put this out last year. It was a book called True Giants. And in the book, the funny thing is I've known Lauren Coleman for years, and I not only have met him many times, and we've corresponded for a long time, but at a conference we were both at several years ago in Greenville, South Carolina, I actually met Mark Hall as well. And the two are, you know, they've known one another for a very long time, and they authored this book together called True Giants that deals with, you know, reports of Bigfoot-type creatures that are larger than the typical, Sasquatch reports, which are typically, these things are pretty big anyway. I mean, you know, when you talk about Bigfoot, we're talking about a creature that is anywhere from maybe, you know, 6 feet or, you know, maybe, you know, even 4 or 5, you know, on the really lower end of the scale, to maybe as much as 12, 13, or 14 feet. But Mark Hall has always talked about these true giants, and indeed he and Coleman put their heads together and came up with a book that deals with some of these stranger reports. Could you imagine a creature that was closer to 20 feet tall? Is that even physically possible? Maybe not, but I'll tell you what, there's some interesting folklore that surrounds all that. But unfortunately, we're up on another break, and so we'll have to wait until we come back to address that. We'll talk a little bit about one of these creatures in the nearby British Isles. It may not be a Grugach, it may not be a Woodwose, but the Big Gray Man of Ben McDooey is indeed a very large, slightly spectral Sasquatch-like critter. We'll talk about him when we come back here on the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out and keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
Today's episode, Rattlesnake at the Pond.
Oh, no, a rattlesnake! Jesse, help! You will, but first you want to talk about shelter pets? The majority of pets in shelters are there due to owner-related issues like divorce or allergies. Save us, Sassy! What, Sassy? You wish you were videotaping this? Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
As unlikely as it seems that there might be 20-foot-tall creatures wandering around there, real giants. This is indeed a theory that has been put forth in the past by the likes of Mark Hall and the world-renowned cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman. He has worked hard to develop a good name, and he's maintained that by being one of the best. That's the truth. And in their book, True Giants, they address stories of what is known as the Fir Liath, or the Gray Man, the Big Gray Man of Ben McDooey, which is a creature, or sometimes described as kind of a specter, that's said to haunt the highest summit and passes of a mountain, which is called Ben McDooey. It is the highest peak of the Cairngorms and the second highest peak in all of Britain. It's supposed to be a extremely tall figure. Some of the legends describe it as being hairy like a Bigfoot, and many who are climbing the mountain describe feeling very uneasy feelings and sensations, often the sense that they are being followed by something and hearing large footsteps that tend to follow them along as they're climbing to the summit of the mountain. In 1925, noted mountain climber John Norman Colley recounted a terrifying experience that he had while he was climbing the mountain some 35 years earlier. He said, "I had begun to think I had heard something else than merely the noise of my own footsteps. It was just like so many other encounters like this tend to begin." He said, "For every few steps I took, I would hear a crunch and then another crunch as if someone were walking along the stony path behind me, but that they were taking steps three or four times the length of my own." Well, Collie was unable to make out the source of the noises because of the mist, but he says, "As the eerie crunch, crunch, crunch sounded behind me, I was seized with terror and suddenly took to my heels, staggering blindly among the boulders for 4 or 5 miles. Other climbers have also reported having the same sort of thing happen, many describing this uncontrollable fear or panic that sets in. And some actually even say that they see a huge gray figure stumbling along behind them, often 10, 15, maybe 20 feet tall. Some have just said that they hear the sounds, and then, of course, that uncontrollable feeling of panic and terror that sweeps in. It's very strange, but many people say that actually what this is called is what is known as the Brocken Specter, or the Brocken Bow, or the Mountain Specter. Glocken Specter is another name for it. What it denotes essentially is an apparent, very large, magnified shadow from the observer themselves that's cast onto the upper surfaces of clouds around them, or fog, opposite of where they stand in relation to the sun. And that, indeed, this is probably what people are seeing. So you hear that expression, scared of your own shadow? Indeed, probably the legends around the big man, or the big gray man of Ben McDooey, probably stem more from people seeing reflections on airborne mists of their own shadow. But that can't be used to describe, a plausible explanation behind so many of these other Sasquatch reports. I don't know what to make of them. I've never seen a Bigfoot. I've talked to a lot of people, though, over the years who have. I think I was just in my early teens, probably, when I was first introduced by a fellow by the name of Bruce Smith. And Bruce had been a friend of my mom and dad's for years, and I'd been very interested in Bigfoot for a number of years already, and I'd been told that, well, Bruce saw a wild man. You should go talk to him. And I thought, a wild man? And what was even stranger about this was that Bruce had had this encounter only maybe 30 minutes to an hour from right here in Asheville, North Carolina, over in a part of the country known as Madison County. And he had been visiting with relatives, and he said that one night he'd been told with his cousin to go out to the chicken house, and they were going to get some eggs to bring back to make dinner. And he says that as he and his cousin started up the hill, that they saw what they thought initially was a black bear that was raiding the chicken house. And so they thought, well, we knew that, you know, black bears typically, if you make a little noise, they'll run off and everything, and we weren't too scared, so we started shouting and grabbing sticks and things. And of course, you don't want to get close to a black bear, but again, yeah, they typically will try and run off before they will engage in hand-to-hand bear-to-man combat. And they said that as they began to make noise to get this thing away from the chicken house, that whatever it was came out of the chicken house. It had been partially inside the chicken house, gathering eggs, presumably. And Bruce said that the thing came out, and he said, now, the chicken house at the top probably was 6 feet off the ground. If you were to put your hand up and place it up on top, that would probably be about 6 feet up off the ground, so it was taller than a person. He said the thing that came out of that chicken house was head and shoulders taller than that chicken house. So he said, I knew it was taller than 6 feet. He said, not only was it covered in hair, it was standing upright. It had a man-like face, and it looked right at us, and it was dropping eggs as it started running back off into the forest. And he says, but the most distinct feature about this creature, this thing that I saw, and he never called it a creature. He always, because I asked him, I said, what do you think it was, Bruce? He said, you know, for all I know, it was some crazy old man. He referred to it as a person. He said it was some sort of a person, but it was huge and it was covered in hair. But he said that the most distinct feature was, he said that it had the weirdest looking hands. He said that the hands looked so crooked. The skin on the hands was very white, and so was the face, and then it was dark black or brown hair on the rest of the body. But he said that it had these weird, long, crooked looking fingers, and it was holding eggs, and as it ran off, it was dropping eggs behind it. And that's what he said he saw. And you talk about a story that, boy, you live out in the remote parts of you know, Asheville, North Carolina, here in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains. We call them the dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains for a good reason. And I'll tell you what, folks, it can be quite shocking. But anyway, when you hear stories like that, what are you supposed to make of those? Who knows? But again, you know, they may just be that. They may just be stories. It seems that there is at least some credible basis for some of these stories of large creatures like Bigfoot and the like, but I don't know. But, you know, looking back further, I touched on something earlier, and we meant to get to it, and then I think that we went off down the road toward, you know, strange creatures. I think it was that the folks in the chat room were talking about Zana, and so we stayed on the Sasquatch subject for a little longer. But looking a bit further back, what if we as humans today are such as a result of mutations that occurred in ancient times? Are we all mutants?
Does that mean I get, like, claws and a tail and stuff? Really, all I want is a prehensile tail. That's all I'm asking for.
Is that, like, Nightcrawler? Are you make...
No, I don't want, like, a demon tail with a point. I want a a New World monkey tail, like a
capuchin.
You don't want
to be all freakish
or a helper
and
monkey
stuff.
I want to be, like, well, like Kakarot.
Well, Kakarot!
And... because it'd be so cool, I'd have a monkey tail, I could hang from things, I could use it as a belt. Anytime I wear brown shoes, hey, look at my fancy fur belt. I'd have a cool belt, I could carry...
That'd be a cool belt, all right.
I could triple fist. Who can triple fist? Oh, me, because I've got a tail. You know, I could do all kinds of things.
It sounds like you've got it all figured out. You know, you must have thought a good bit about what it would be like having a monkey tail.
I've wanted a tail since I was in the third grade.
You know, I wouldn't mind having a prehensile tail, because then it would allow me to throw pins at our engineer without having to turn around and look at him.
Although I wonder if having prehensile tails, we would therefore be slightly just genetically enough like monkeys, and it wouldn't be pins you'd be throwing it at man.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, the monkeys have a propensity for throwing, something else at their
enemy. You guys and your singularity... and your prehensile tails, and
you just want to be boring old people, don't you?
Here comes old people Matt Oakley.
Look at him. He has two arms and 10 fingers.
It's weird, man. I know, but, you know, I think there's way more to be discovered with us as we are now.
Oh, Matt. He is a victim of mind control. He's a victim of mind control.
He is. He is. You know what?
No, I can tell you.
I bet you like that Ron Paul character, too, don't you?
Oh, gosh. He probably doesn't even watch Fox News and CNN.
Nope.
Nope.
That's not me.
Well, I'll tell you what. I bet Matt could probably tell us all about what it's like to be a brainwashed idiot. But before we get into that, I do want to say, let me draw attention to one of our sister websites. Our good friends in Australia, Ben and Aaron, with Mysterious Universe. I wrote an article for him recently called Man or Mutant is Human Language the Product of Bizarre Mutation. Now, this is serious. And I just want to get to a relevant quote or two here. Okay? There are a lot of theories about how human language actually evolved and the origin of human language was in ancient times. But now, one of the most gifted and controversial linguists of our time is none other than the political critic and commentator Noam Chomsky. I'm going to read a section here from this article. I find this fascinating because I've always kind of followed the logic that language probably developed from our early ancestors mimicking the sounds of other animals. And in doing so, they would use these sounds to alert others of their kind of the potential dangers involved with the presence of predators, saber-toothed cats or whatever, or saber-toothed walruses, or God knows, anyway. But in basically mimicking sounds that language may have developed from that, Chomsky, okay, despite being one of the, one of the most brilliant linguists of our time, he doesn't, endorse that theory at all. What he thinks happens is actually quite different and pretty shocking, too. He says, there's a long history of study of origin of language, asking how it arose from calls of apes and so forth, essentially just what I've outlined. And he says that, actually he wrote this in 1988, so it's not a recent statement, but Chomsky has said that investigation of this, in my view, is a complete waste of time, because language is based on an entirely different principle than any animal communication system that we know of. He also says that, and this is really bizarre, but let's suspend our disbelief for a moment. I'll put it to you like Chomsky did. He says, to tell a fairy story about it, human language is almost as if there were some higher primate wandering around a long time ago that was the result of some random mutation that took place, maybe after some strange cosmic ray shower, Chomsky wrote. And this cosmic ray shower somehow reorganized the brain, implanting a language organ in an otherwise primate brain. This may be closer to reality than many other quote-unquote fairy tales that are told about evolutionary processes, including language. And then again in 2004, Chomsky's essay, Language and Mind, Current Thoughts on Ancient Problems, further argued his feelings that some, quote, instantaneous emergence of language might have actually occurred. Very interesting. In other words, Chomsky has literally argued that some strange sort of mutation, perhaps the result of some sort of external influence, maybe a cosmic ray shower or something similar to it, could have literally resulted in a near-perfect, early spoken language that literally may have erupted into use by ancient humans overnight. But if that's the case, what I have to ask is this. If that kind of thing, if there's even a remote possibility that this kind of thing could have happened at some point in our past, if we were bombarded by a cosmic ray shower in the future, are other animals going to leap up and start talking? Are they going to mutate? Like Chomsky said, are we going to have talking manimals in addition to humans? That's an interesting theory. It seems unlikely. And again, I guess that the point is that I think that what Chomsky would argue is that humans were already close enough, or rather early humans were already close enough to being the people that we are today, and it was more conducive for this sort of a, mutation along the lines of what Mr. Chomsky has theorized to take place.
Well, again, coming from the chat room, seeing as it's apparently my job to moderate the chat room, which I enjoy doing. It is not a task, I assure you. RPJ said, you know, concerning mutants, he suggested that I get... he actually said, Chris, comma, you, all caps, have got to get Jeff Cripple, or according to his website, as his immediate family pronounces his last name, Cripple, to be a guest on our show. And he sent me a link to an Amazon link to his book, and it looks really cool. It's called Mutants and Mystics: Science Fiction, Superhero Comics, and the Paranormal.
I've heard about this book, yeah.
And I'm at his website from Rice University right now, and everything he has to say seems incredibly legit. He's a religious studies professor. The only issue is, and if any listeners out there are what I'm going to refer to as these academic types, the only issue with a lot of these academic types, you know, the active professors in universities, is it's really incredibly hard to get their contact information.
Right.
As far as even like a faculty email or some, you know, incredibly professional email. I don't want to try to like search for your home email address or anything like that, but it would be nice to be able to, you know, get in touch with you somehow. And so I'm going to endeavor to find Jeff Cripple. He gives three pronunciations in his frequently asked questions. I'm going to endeavor to get him, or at least get in contact with him and talk to him, if not get him on the show entirely.
I think that'd be great. I think we need to, that would be an ideal person to talk to about this very sort of thing, because, you know, I'm interested in, and I know that the premise of the book there is more, has more to do, I guess, with, you know, cultural and even philosophical parallels that can be made between humans and, you know, of course, you know, superheroes and things like that. But taking into consideration, you know, how we have evolved into what we are today versus, you know, other, you know, our ancient ancestors, and in relation to other animals and animal life here on planet Earth, it is interesting. I think it's called discontinuity theory, what Noam Chomsky is advocating. In other words, that there's some sort of a radical change that took place in a short amount of time, and boom, people are walking around talking, or at least one of us was, and then that was passed along. I don't know exactly how that, you know, takes place. Again, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot more that's written about that than what we're getting into here on the program, but it is interesting. It's very interesting, and it's the kind of thing that we like to touch on and discuss, well, more on this program, as opposed to the kind of mindless dribble that occurs out there in the mainstream every day. You know, I'm speaking of mindless dribble, I'm just about sick of hearing about sexual abuse scandal and Herman Cain. You know, truly, I mean, you know, what else can be said about this? Now, I don't know, I'm not saying that the guy did something or that he didn't, but for the last 3 or 4 days, every morning I wake up and the every headline everywhere is another woman speaks out, another, and you know, hey, if he is a scumbag and he has done, you know, awful things and made, you know, unwanted advances against people, it should probably be ousted, and then that should be that, and it should be taken care of, you know. But the thing is that I just love the way that the media gets so preoccupied with these sorts of stories. Meanwhile, looking across the great big pond, you know, we're hearing stories about, you know, whispers of war. I mean, you know, I've heard that Netanyahu's been trying to gather support for preemptive strikes against Iran, potentially. Meanwhile, you know, Tehran's nuclear facilities are right now just about to be functional. You know, missiles have been sold to Iran by China and against UN protocols. The United States has also been tossing around the idea of preemptive strikes. The United Kingdom has said, you know, Britain has said that they'll back up the United States if a preemptive strike is made against Iran. This is really, really dangerous stuff. And in the grand scheme of things, I don't mean to diminish the stories, you know, about Herman Cain. You know, like him, dislike him, whether or not there's truth or not to these stories. I'm not trying to diminish all that stuff, but there's so much more going on in the world today. And yet the non-issues are so often the things that make their way to the top of the news sites, you know, the front page headlines, so to speak. It's mindless dribble, mindless self-indulgence even. And I'll tell you what, when it comes to mindlessness, Well, probably no one knows mindlessness better than Matt Oakley. But I don't mean that in a bad way. No, Matt's going to be telling us about, well, how to tell if you are a victim of mind control when we come back from this break. Right, Matt?
Well, I guess so. I mean, you keep kind of, you know, making slights against me in reference to this article, so...
Maybe it should be tucked in signs that you are a conspiracy theorist. Like, Matt, oh, I'm kidding. Okay, when we come back, we'll have that. I'm Micah Hanks. It's the Graylian Report. As a parent, you can't help but look at your child and wonder what the future holds. You may dream about the possibility of your son or daughter becoming a professional athlete or a renowned heart surgeon. But while you're dreaming, consider this. The odds that your child will be diagnosed with autism are 1 in 110. Knowing the signs of autism and getting an early diagnosis could make a world of difference to your child and to you. To learn the signs, visit AutismSpeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Are you facing foreclosure? Then come down to Megalow and Partners. We're a mortgage rescue company, and we can help you keep your house. Provided you submit to our plans for galactic domination. No, I'm kidding.
If you're facing foreclosure, talk to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Oh gosh, it's finally the last segment of tonight's show. The guys in here, I think Chris is finally the zombie aspect of his... Of
Chris has some paranormal activity going on over there.
He's finally... his brain's finally taking over. And the zombie virus, that is. And it's finally turning him into an actual zombie. You know, you did so well for so long, and I guess it's time to go ahead and let him go. Matt, would you get the 12-gauge?
The gun lock's on it. Do you have the key?
Somebody better get that shotgun quick.
As discussed earlier in the chat room, if you two were around, you should beware because me and my ilk are not afraid of fire.
Yeah, but you're afraid of boomsticks, Baka. Yeah. Would you get the shotgun, Matt?
You know what?
I'm
going to
ask you again.
I'll go get it.
If you just give me a little bit of brains, I'll go back to normal.
I'll give Matt 10 minutes to do seven.
Just...
Yeah, guys, just I kind of feel I shortchanged everybody this week because I only got seven. Instead of 10.
Matt, you're not any good at all.
I know.
You're fired, actually.
Can I have my job back so I can do the 7?
No.
Wait. What? Does that mean I have to read his horrible handwriting?
Yeah. Anyway, Matt, did you have something that you were going to read to us there?
I got fired.
Chris, did you fire him? Let him come back.
You just fired
him. I didn't fire him. You did.
I didn't fire him. Nobody fired him.
Oh, yeah. No one has hiring or firing power here except for me. So, Matt, you just ignore it.
Okay, look, let's let him do his thing. Okay, Matt, go for it.
Okay, so this week we have the top seven.
You don't have to yell.
But the top seven signs that you may be under mind control. And this is a pretty vague description of mind control. This isn't from anything specific like the government or aliens or Chris.
Tapeworms.
But just generally, here are seven signs you may be under the influence of mind control. Number one, dreaming in the third person, as in seeing yourself as a separate person in the dream.
Wait a minute, home. What if you're like a cow? Because, I mean, have I ever told you about this dream?
Yeah, I think when we did the...
Every time we've ever done a top 10, I tell you about this.
Pretty much.
Okay, sorry.
It started with the... what was it? The goofer.
It started with the bad goofer.
Yeah.
From the voodoo curse. And as I got closer to the cliff, I was a cow, and I walk right off the cliff. And then I wake up, and then there's a snake man sitting, like, on top of me, like, sucking my soul out. And then I wake up again, and then there's aliens, and then I wake up a third time, and I was really awake.
And Chris is sitting on top of you.
But that was real that time. So,
hang on. What's the significance of third person versus first person? I mean, really,
if you're a cow and you're dreaming, then you're under mind control.
If you got an OBE, that's third person. If you're seeing shadow people in sleep paralysis, is probably
what's OBE? Old bad Eddie.
Yeah, old bad Eddie. If you're having an old bad Eddie, then it's gonna be a third person old bad Eddie, because you know Eddie only talks about Eddie like this. Like, man, you don't want to rile Eddie. You done rile the wrong Eddie.
You done rile the wrong Eddie.
So what it says is excruciatingly vivid dreams, including details we aren't supposed to be able to recreate in the dream state.
Example.
Which has nothing to do with, like, dreaming in the third person, really, but it's part of the same, you know, stipulation.
We've got a really technical term for that in what I like to call, since I'm now involved, in what I like to call the biz. We've got a really technical term for what you just read, Matt. I scratched my mustache. I'm sorry for that noise. It's called BS.
Oh.
Absolute.
No, dude. Absolute
best scenario.
That's true.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so number two, we got...
Wait a minute. We're not even on number three yet?
No. Chris keeps bringing up his BS and stuff.
Show you BS.
Number two.
All right, number two. Precognitive dreams. Especially if places, he keeps switching to between you and I. So as the sentence reads, precognitive dreams, especially if places I will go in the future and people I will meet. So if you have dreams about where this guy will go and who he will meet, you're probably under mind control.
I have way worse things to worry about than mind control.
How do I even know who he actually is?
It's anonymous.
They were sent by he who is called I Am.
Were they sent by ancient aliens? Look what I've got here, guys. I've got Philip Coppin's new book, The Ancient Alien Questions. What if in ancient times aliens actually mind controlled us?
Conclusive proof.
Actually, look who wrote the foreword. It was Eric Von Daniken, not Giorgio.
Not his lackey. Yeah, I said
But here's Giorgio. Giorgio on the back actually says the following. He says, the ancient alien question provides a captivating adventure around the world and sheds an interesting perspective on the ancient astronaut theory. So, but anyway.
You got to say it right, Micah.
What?
Ancient astronaut.
Ancient astronaut.
Would you like me to do a good quote of...
Wait, hold on. Are you being mind controlled by Giorgio Tsoukalos?
I think possibly. Where's his quote?
Second one down.
It says ancient alien, not astronaut. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, because he quoted the title of the book. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then.
Which looks like a very good book.
Oh, no, but he says it later. Hang on.
Okay.
Back in.
Clearly, the ancient alien question provides a captivating adventure around the world that sheds an interesting perspective on the ancient astronaut's theory. It raises questions that cumulative and well thought out, and sometimes downright startling conclusions or conclusive proof a must read for anyone who wants to expand their knowledge horizon in this kick-ass field and who also wants to be berated by me on Twitter. All right.
Yeah, hold on, it doesn't say that. No, this looks like a really good book. And Philip Coppens, you know, he's, hey, you know, I'll tell you something else. Scotty Roberts, okay, over at Intrepid Magazine, and I, we've even, Scotty's come on the program and talked with us about this. We're going to try and get a 2012 event together, okay? You know, we want to try and put together something in 2012 because it's going to be such a world-changing year for everyone.
Yeah, we haven't been pitching this as much lately.
Well, because we're still getting some details together, you know. But as we're getting details together, I don't think it's premature to say that, you know, Scotty spoke to Philip Coppens the other day, and I think hopefully that we can get Brother Coppens more involved as well, because this new book, The Ancient Alien Question, looks fantastic. We've got Tom Fusco coming on the program next week. And then we've also got, who else have we got lined up? We heard some music from Max Maloney earlier. And then we also have Nigel Kerner's going to be on the program early next year. But I'd like to get Philip Coppens on as soon as possible. And, of course, we've got this ongoing project, which involves getting, you know, the master of mind control himself, Mr. Alex Jones, on the program. But that said, we'll go ahead and defer back to Matthew. Where are we now? Number three, my friend?
Yeah, we're on number three.
It's only number three. We've got a long way to go.
Odd obsessions with certain places, numbers, or phrases. So you're probably under
number nine. Number nine. Number nine. You remember that? Huh? Number nine. You remember that?
No. I'm drawing a blank.
It was the Beatles, anyway.
Oh.
Number?
No, that's why, because...
Yeah, because I don't like the Beatles.
What? Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and say it.
You either like Elvis or the Beatles, and if you like the Beatles, you're not my friend.
I think I'm going to be sad. I think it's the day.
I'm Elvis person.
Well, I'm a Beatles guy. I'm sorry.
Well, that's great. I mean, I'm neither, but, you know...
It's a zombie, spoken like a true zombie.
I don't know, man. I don't like thieves, and I don't like... poor musicianship. So there you go.
Thieves.
Did I say thieves?
Who's a thief?
There's thieves.
And furthermore, who's a poor musicianship?
Have you ever heard any drum track ever on any Beatles song ever?
The other guys played pretty well. You know, Ringo wasn't a terrible drummer.
George Harrison was the only Beatle worth a crap.
Oh, come on. George was really good. Actually, Paul McCartney. You know, John, actually, you know, they were all really good guitarists. Hey, how many guitars do you play?
I play none, but I don't pretend to.
Yeah, you don't, but they don't either. Those guys could do it. As a matter of fact, Paul could play left-handed. Of course, then again, he was left-handed. But yeah, anyway.
So am I.
So, but he's dead. It doesn't matter, right? You know, he's dead, and it's been an impersonator.
Paul is dead.
You know what? How about this? I'm going to bring up another quote from George Carlin.
Okay.
The late, great George Carlin said about the Beatles. The wrong two Beatles died first.
Oh, God. You know what it is? I'll tell you exactly what it is, man. You are under the mind-controlling effects of a bad goofer. Matt, number five?
Oh, we're on four.
Oh, damn it!
Okay, difficulty placing thoughts in a context of time, whether it happened 3 days ago or 3 months ago.
Number five?
Number five. Nobody's got anything to say about that one? All right.
I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, well. Yeah, I hate you.
I just started a flame war in the chat.
Let's see if Matt can count to five, Chris.
Okay, five. And this is in quotations, memories of things that never happened.
Knew it was.
Isn't that just dreams? I mean,
isn't
seriously.
That just like last night's drunk?
No. You know, not even, you know, figuring in, you know, any indiscretions you make. You know, I've had... dreams or even daydreams that are incredibly vivid, and you know, I had a little trouble thinking whether they were real or not, because I was at the time I was on the nicotine patch, and those are awesome dreams. But it's entirely possible to, of your own volition, dream up something or someone or anything that you have no frame of reference for. Like you can dream up a person that you've never ever seen or is even physically resembling anyone you've ever seen. And you,
Chris, who doesn't exist? What's the girl's name who doesn't exist?
Lots of people don't exist.
Uh-oh.
You better hurry up. I'll hush.
You know what that means? That means you got 1 minute, Matt, and two way to go.
Good Lord. All right, six. Odd, but very specific abilities such as being able to identify people by the way they use language and knowing mental states by subtle facial cues.
And number seven, our final moment. Matt gets the last word as usual.
Memory gaps that seem to indicate some sort of fugue state. For example, waking up in the sixth grade in a school I'd never seen before and never been in with homework in front of me I hadn't done. So if you have had a dream of, you know, this guy being in a school that he had never seen before doing homework he hadn't done, then you might be under mind control.
Yes, and unfortunately we're done controlling your mind for this week's edition of the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all those here involved with the program, have a wonderful week, folks, and until next time, stay strange.